Good morning. I am Al Wally, Administrative Law Judge, pursuant to temporary appointment designated by the Office of Administrative Hearings upon the request of the North Dakota Public Service Commission to serve as the hearing officer for this consolidated hearing. This is the consolidated hearing of the separate applications of Montana Dakota Utilities Co. for an advanced determination of prudence and for a certificate of public convenience and necessity to construct, own, and operate an 88-megawatt simple cycle combustion turbine. These applications are North Dakota Public Service Commission cases number PU-11-395 and PU-11-396, respectively. Before proceeding with this consolidated hearing, I will ask the commissioners for their comments and any directions for the hearing. Commission President Tony Clark.
Good morning to everyone. Just note that I've appreciated having the opportunity to read the pre-filed testimony and look forward to a good hearing here today.
Commissioner Kevin Kramer.
Thank you and good morning. Same, by the way, thank you for the very timely pre-filed testimony rebuttal as well from both parties. Appreciate that very much. I guess with regard to direction, I might just say a couple of things. And maybe it's obvious, but a couple of the questions I want to explore as much as anything is, does prudent mean least cost? I think that's an important distinction for me after reading the testimony. Also, given sort of the somewhat uniqueness of our ADP law, can a plant be prudent without, being necessary, without being without a PCNN? And the reason I asked the question that way, of course, is that this part of the law that makes prudence an ADP, I guess, gives the rebuttable presumption to an ADP when built in the state. You've heard heard us say in the past when we've had ADP cases in front of us of plants outside of or investment outside of the state that should we decide not to issue an ADP is not an indictment, of course, on the prudence and shouldn't be taken as such, although we've been pressured into that many times by the company saying, but if not, it won't get built. In this situation, clearly, with the rebuttable presumption and the burden being on the advocates, you're going to try to prove it appears that it is not prudent. And so the ramifications of that are paramount in my mind. So with that, I mean, there are some other issues I think that are pretty obvious that I know you're going to dig into based on the testimony at this point. And I just look forward to a thorough hearing.
Commissioner Brian Kalk.
Good morning. Just look forward to hearing the testimony and the question and answer phase. Thank you very much.
The record will show that it is a little after 9 o'clock a.m., January 10, 2012, at the hearing room of the North Dakota Public Service Commission, Capitol Building, Bismarck. The time, date, and place duly noticed pursuant to and in accordance with statute and rule for the consolidated hearing of the applications of Montana Dakota Utilities Co. for an advance determination of prudence and certificate of public convenience and necessity to construct, own, and operate an 88-megawatt simple cycle combustion turbine. The notice of consolidated hearing for this hearing issued by the Commission dated October 26, 2011 specified the issues to be considered and determined in each case upon this consolidated hearing as first, for the determination of prudence of the construction of the facility, whether the resource addition is prudent, and second, for the determination of the public convenience and necessity, whether public convenience and necessity will be served by the construction, ownership, and operation of the facility, and two, whether the applicant is fit, willing, and able to provide service. Counsel, please state your appearance for the record. Mr. Kuntz.
Thank you. Daniel S. Kuntz for the applicant, Montana Dakota Utilities Co. Also with me is co-counsel Paul Sanderson with the firm Azure Kermis and Smith. And see that table is our Vice President, Andreas Stomberg.
Mr. Grumman.
Good morning. Mark Grumman, representing advocacy staff. Next to me is Richard Hahn of the Capra Associates, and also Chris Merle from advocacy staff, and Mike Diller as well from advocacy staff.
And Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco.
Ilana Jeffcoat-Sacco, general counsel with the commission as advisor to the commission, and also with me is Patrick Fawn, the director of compliance and competitive markets for the commission.
Let me add, please, that if there is anyone present other than those persons who will testify on behalf of Montana Dakota or the commission advocacy staff who would address the commission regarding either or both of these cases, I ask, please, that you talk to me during any recess of the hearing to arrange to do that. Not that you need any permission from me to do that, but that so I can assist you and advise you for your testimony to the commission. That's true also if there happens to be anybody listening to the Internet streaming who has an interest in either of these or both of these cases and would address the commission later on in the day. You're certainly welcome. And again, I ask, please, that you talk to me during a recess of the hearing to do that. If you have any documents, photographs, other things which you would like to have part of the record for the commission to consider, I will certainly be willing, indeed, pleased to help you with that, to get those marked as exhibits and to get them made part of the record. I'm expecting that the hearing will go past the noon hour, but we will recess for lunch, and I will remain here to, again, for anybody who might wish to address the commission, and I am certainly willing to talk to you at that time. With that, Mr. Kuntz, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Commissioners, before you are statements, confidentiality statements. We are prepared to hand out the exhibits, exhibit book that includes the staff's testimony and exhibits as well. Some of those exhibits have confidential trade secret information. The commission has already determined trade secret. Once you've signed those statements, I believe everybody else in the room would have signed, non-company personnel would have signed the statement, except you have... And then we'll hand out the exhibits, and Mark and I will move their admission. So if you can sign those and hand them down to the judge.
And, commissioners, while Mr. Kuntz is distributing the exhibits, I have for your advice, and the additional question is how to deal with the audio record of the hearing. We have two options. One would be to have a complete audio record of the hearing, including trade secret information. Then, if it's consistent with the commission's policy, that audio record would be sealed, as would the trade secret information normally be sealed, and would be available to the public upon request and, of course, upon executing the protective order. Alternatively, in accordance with the commission's practice of making the audio record available on the Internet, we would have to recess the hearing for the trade secret, for any testimony regarding the trade secret information, place a new card in the system, make a recording of that portion, recess again to replace the card, continue the test of the record for the non-secret information. This can be done, but Mr. Kuntz advises me that in the circumstances of this hearing, it's likely that there will be repeated testimony regarding trade secret information, and it's going to prolong the hearing. Yeah. So if it's consistent with the commission's policy and with the wishes of the commissioners, I suggest that we simply continue the audio recording, have it sealed as trade secret information in place of the usual listing on the internet website for the record, the audio record of the hearing. Simply say something to the effect that the audio record contains trade secret information. Please contact the commission for if you wish to review the audio record. So, what is the wish, Commissioner Clark? What is the wish of the commissioners?
That's certainly acceptable to me. I don't know what I think for efficiency's sake, it's probably the best way to proceed.
That makes sense to me. The only thing, question I would ask is how we're going to work with the live internet feed.
No, that will be stopped.
So we'll manage
The witnesses, and let me just say this now, the witnesses should be aware of when they need to address, talk about trade secret information. Just say that. I'm going to talk about trade secret information. Give me a minute to stop the internet streaming. And then I guess you're going to have to, I may not be aware, but somehow you should again signal to me that that you've concluded your testimony regarding any trade secret information. Again, give me half a second and you'll see the red light go on and we'll be back on the internet. All right, that'll be our procedure then, Mr. Kuntz.
Thank you, Your Honor, and at this time, I believe Mr. Grubin and myself have a joint motion for myself. I would move the foundation, the mission of exhibits MDU 101 to 112.
Mr. Grubin?
Yeah, advocacy staff concurs. We so stipulate.
And you're going to move the, why don't you at the same time move the mission of your exhibits?
And at this time, we motion to submit all of our exhibits, and we request stipulation for foundation and all other matters from MDU.
Mr. Kuntz?
Agreed.
Yes. All right. For the record, exhibits MDU 101 through MDU 112 are each received, and Commission staff advocacy exhibits RSH 1 through and including RSH 11 are each received. Mr. Kuntz.
Thank you, Your Honor. This is an application, as the Commission knows, for an advanced determination of prudence and certificates of public convenience and necessity to build an 88-megawatt simple cycle combustion turbine. For electric generation purposes, the project would be built just north of Mandan on a site with our Heskett generation station. The project includes approximately a 24-mile, 10-inch natural gas pipeline, which would be the fuel source for this combustion turbine. The capacity of MDU's existing electric generation resources have been less than its peak demand of its customers for a number of years. That deficit has been met over the last several years with power purchase agreements from other utilities. With the current power purchase agreement set to expire in 2015, and with continued customer growth, that deficit between our existing resources and our demand is expected to be about 149 megawatts in 2015. That's about 25% of the company's capacity needs. In the course of planning to meet these generation needs on the expiration of the current power purchase agreement, the company issued a request for proposals for generation resources in 2010. They then conducted least cost resource modeling using responses from that request, as well as self-built proposal alternatives. The results of that planning efforts demonstrated a need for an addition of a combustion turbine in 2015. Primarily for capacity purposes. That CT resources was reflected in the company's 2011 IRP, Integrated Resource Plan, that was filed with the commission, and then the company filed this application for its ADP and the PCNNs. The staff does not disagree with the need for the company needs to add generation resources in 2015. However, they suggest that a power purchase agreement for a CT capacity resource in Illinois would be a lesser cost alternative. Under the MISO resource capacity construct that's currently being considered by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. The company is doubtful that MDU could use this facility to meet its generation resource needs, at least not without incurring additional transportation costs that weren't considered in the staff's analysis. The PPA then, the Illinois PPA then, would simply become basically a financial hedge against MDU's capacity deficit in purchasing capacity on the MISO annual market as proposed by MISO. Also, the staff's analysis does not consider the locational benefits of an on-system resource, which there are several that shall be testified to by Ms. Stomberg and Mr. Nigam. When you consider the risks of the Illinois Power Purchase Agreement proposal and the benefits of a self-build on-system resource, the 88-megawatt combustion turbine is not only the better proposal, it's also the least cost proposal in this instance. I would note, as Commissioner Kramer noted, this proposal is for a North Dakota resource, and the North Dakota ADP statute has some special considerations for North Dakota resource. Although MDU believes this is a prudent resource addition under any analysis, the statute does provide additional considerations for a North Dakota resource. First is that it's a rebuttable presumption of prudence. That means that the staff has the burden of proving that the resource is not prudent. And second of all, the commission is required to consider the benefits of locating the resource in North Dakota. Ms. Stomberg will discuss some of those benefits that only further the case in support of this particular resource. Montana Dakota will be calling two witnesses, Ms. Stomberg and Mr. Nigam, to provide live testimony. In addition, pre-filed testimony was provided by Mr. Welty and Mr. Mormon. Staff has indicated they do not have any cross-examination for those witnesses, so we will not call them to summarize their pre-filed testimony. Their pre-filed testimony has been stipulated, but both gentlemen are in the room and available to answer questions if the commission has cross-examination questions for them, as well as we have other resources available. If questions come up regarding any aspect of this project, hopefully that we will have someone here that can answer those questions for the commission. With that, that completes my opening, Your Honor.
Mr. Grumman, will you make an opening statement at this time?
Just very briefly, Your Honor. Thank you. Our direct will consist of testimony from Richard Hahn, who will discuss the issues so explained by Mr. Kuntz. We look forward to a good hearing today. Thank you.
Do you have an opening statement?
No. Thank you.
We would call Ms. Stomberg, please.
Ms. Stomberg, as you know, your testimony is required to be under oath, and I'm required by law to advise you regarding perjury before administering the oath. Perjury is a false statement of material fact which you do not believe to be true. In North Dakota, perjury is a Class C felony, punishable by a fine up to $5,000, imprisonment for a period of up to 5 years or more. Will you raise your right hand, please? Being advised regarding perjury, Ms. Stomberg, do you swear that the testimony which you're about to give in this matter shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth? Mr.
Kuntz.
Thank you, Your Honor. Would you please state your name?
Andrea Lee Stomberg.
Ms. Stomberg, you're employed by Montana Dakota Utilities Co.
I am.
And you prepared pre-filed direct and pre-filed rebuttal testimony in this case?
I did.
And that testimony contained a summary of your work experience and responsibilities in your position with Montana Dakota?
I did.
And do you have any corrections or additions to that testimony at this time?
I do not.
And if I ask you the questions that appeared in that direct and rebuttal testimony, your responses today would be the same?
They would be.
Could you provide the commission with a summary of your direct testimony at this point?
Certainly. And I'm going to go slowly. I've practiced it slowly. In my direct testimony for this request, I introduced Montana Dakota's proposal to construct an 88-megawatt gas-fired combustion turbine, along with transmission interconnection facilities and a 25-mile natural gas pipeline to provide fuel to the turbine. This turbine will be sited at the Heskett Station north of Mandan, North Dakota, which allows the company to utilize existing infrastructure and staff and made this site the least cost location of the several possible locations studied. Construction will begin in 2013, and the plant is expected to be online before summer peak in 2015. Mr. Alan Welty's pre-filed testimony discussed the siting considerations as well as turbine type selection. During 2011, Montana Dakota purchased about 20% of both our customers' energy and capacity needs from the MISO market or other entities. We have a forecast capacity deficit of about 150 megawatts in 2015 when existing contracts expire, and we are experiencing significant growth, particularly in western North Dakota. This turbine will be added to our system to provide capacity and will be used as a peaking resource. As described in Montana Dakota's 2011 Integrated Resource Plan submitted in May of 2011, this turbine was selected after least cost modeling and consideration of other factors indicated it was the best option to provide needed capacity to serve load. In evaluating ways to meet our capacity need, Montana Dakota issued a request for proposals, evaluated many options, and conducted least cost modeling, as will be discussed by Mr. Darcy Nigam. Montana Dakota considered coal as well as gas-fueled resources. While coal generation can provide great long-term value to customers, constructing new coal, especially sized to roughly meet our needs, is cost prohibitive. And while natural gas for many years was considered a risky fuel based on pricing and supply instability, Mr. Bob Mormon's pre-filed testimony discussed the gas supply and pricing forecasts lead us to believe that a gas-fired resource is the best cost selection for this peaking facility. This concludes my summary of my direct testimony.
And you also provided rebuttal testimony, did you not?
I did.
And at this time, Ms. Stomberg, could you provide a summary of your rebuttal testimony for the commissioners?
Certainly. Montana Dakota submitted rebuttal testimony to this commission in response to Mr. Richard Hahn's testimony of December 12th. Mr. Hahn suggested that Montana Dakota's selection of the 88-megawatt turbine should be rejected as not being least cost. Montana Dakota does not select resources on the basis of cost alone, nor does the Advanced Determination of Prudence statute require that a resource be least cost to be prudent. As noted in our IRP filings, Montana Dakota seeks the best cost resource, considering the results of least cost modeling, expected impacts to customers, market availability of energy and capacity, environmental regulations, the company's existing mix of generation resources, and other factors that may be pertinent. Qualitative factors and hard-to-quantify costs may be important considerations. In the case of the proposed combustion turbine, some of these other considerations include the benefits of having a generating resource located on the Montana Dakota system within our load area as opposed to remote from our service territory. For instance, having a generator at Heskett enhances the reliability of our system. We'll create two jobs at the plant and expected income and property tax revenues of about $700,000 annually, and construction-related state and local sales tax revenues of about $2.9 million, as well as the indirect revenue to the community from ongoing purchases of materials and services to support the facility. Clearly, these benefits do not accrue to our service area if the resource is located in a remote state. Further, an iron-in-the-ground resource in our area will be useful to our customers for many years. For instance, the Miles City turbine has served our customers for almost 40 years, and we are this year retiring two small turbines that have been in service since 1953. A purchase power contract has a finite life and must be replaced at the end of its life at an unknowable cost and availability. While the idea of the Midwest Independent System Operator, or MISO, is that the Upper Midwest be looked at as a large electric system, as a practical matter, local generation remains important to serve local needs. This was illustrated as recently as last month when an outage of Montana Dakota's two Heskett units following a transformer failure left the electric supply in the Bismarck-Mandan area somewhat vulnerable in the event that another transmission or supply interruption in the area occurred. While we are developing multiple electric feeds into the area to provide heightened reliability, these feeds are not yet all in place. During last month's event, we asked our customers to reduce or reschedule their energy use. Had we had the combustion turbine in place, we would have been able to start it to support the community. In the future, even when we have multiple feeds all in service, a disruption to the backbone transmission system could result in a need to run the turbine. The location of this resource also offers financial advantages from reduced transmission costs that are not recognized in least cost modeling. Mr. Nigam will further explain our relationship with Western Area Power Administration, or WAPA, and why having additional generation capability at this location is expected to reduce future costs for our customers. There is another important consideration in selecting this type of resource at this location. A frame unit of this size can be utilized with other equipment and the existing Heskett Unit 1 turbine generator in a combined cycle configuration to produce about 30 megawatts should the 58-year-old Unit 1 become uneconomic due to age or environmental regulations. This would allow Montana Dakota to continue to use a largely depreciated asset rather than abandoning it and replacing it with new resources. That concludes my summary.
Thank you, Mr. Gromberg. Your witness is available for cross-examination.
Mr. Groman.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning.
Good morning.
Do you have copies of your direct and your rebuttal testimony in front of you?
I don't, but I can sure get it.
Okay. Thank you.
Just one more thing up here. Yeah, why don't we do that one? Thank you. Now I do.
Very good. Could you please turn to page 3 of your direct?
I'm there.
Thank you. Lines 15 through 17, if you could just read that very briefly.
15 through 17 of page 3?
Yep.
Of my direct, okay.
Of your direct. And just let me know when you're ready. Oh, right. Go ahead if you want to just read it out loud, or you can read it yourself, too.
Oh, okay. Well, I can. During 2010, Montana Dakota relied on the Midwest Independent System Operator, energy market for 15% of the retail customers' energy requirements. Do you want me to start over?
No, that's
okay. And purchased approximately 20% of the retail customers' capacity resources from other entities. That's actually through line 18.
Thank you. If you could just proceed to the next page, page 4. And now I'd like you to read lines 4 through 6, I guess the end of that sentence.
4 through 6 on page 4?
Yep.
Montana Dakota asserts this level of reliance on the market and others to provide generation capacity to customers results in long-term price and reliability risk to customers.
So my first question is, as indicated on page 3, 15% for energy and 20% for capacity, in your opinion, is too high. Why do you believe that those levels are too high? If you could please explain that to the commission.
Well, I don't think that there's necessarily the perfect percentage that you're aiming for. But I think particularly at this point in time, when we're looking at significant changes in the MISO area market because of plant closures, expected plant closures in response to environmental rules, a lot of uncertainty with the continued operation of the coal-based resource in MISO, that as we continue to rely on that, those prices will continue to increase. Though I have no proof on that, but I think the MISO study that was submitted hints at that. So I do feel that any time you don't control your own resources, you're at risk at what the market is. That's not to say we necessarily have to control all our resources.
And, of course, indicated as well, they're talking about concerns towards reliance, long-term price, and reliability risks. Do you have anything further to expand upon that reasoning, to substantiate that reasoning as far as long-term reliability and price risks?
Well, long-term reliability, I think you're almost always better off controlling your own resources. Price risks, again, market prices go up. And I believe that market prices are going to continue to go up, both for capacity resources are going to become scarcer and scarcer as plants are closed and before additional generation can be built, and that will drive pricing.
Now, in the last two questions, you provided your conclusion or your reasoning behind your statements. My question is, did the company perform any studies or analyses to quantify that risk?
No, not that I am specifically aware of studies or anything like that, no.
If the company were to purchase capacity at long-term fixed prices, what price risk would the customers take under that situation?
They would have a price risk at the end of that PPA.
If you could please expand upon that.
Well, if you have a contract for 20 years for a fixed price, you certainly know your prices for 20 years. And then you're on the market again. If you've built your resource, for instance, you built a CT, we've got some in service for almost 60 years. They are there. They depreciate. They continue to add value at a known cost for their life.
Previously, well, in your testimony, you talk about a 15% energy and a 20% capacity. What levels would your company like to see as far as reliance?
Well, the energy, of course, we purchase on the MISO market when it is less expensive than, you know, what we can generate ourselves. So I'm not sure there's a right answer for that now that we have the MISO market from which to get energy. The capacity, you know, we've had capacity contracts for a long time. When we lost the 66-megawatt contract with Antelope Valley, that was a significant chunk of our capacity. When we were unable to build Big Stone, we continued to look for capacity resources that we understood the pricing on them, and Big Stone, of course, we would have owned. So I think we've always sought to control the bulk of our capacity. I cannot tell you that 12.5% or 15% or 20% is the right answer. We spend a lot of time watching the market, trying to understand what it's going to look like. And that informs our level of comfort, I suppose.
Well, if you could help us as ratepayers, I guess our question is, when you're watching the market or what you're talking about, I mean, is there any analysis or anything objective quantified as far as your reasoning behind those decisions, or is it more gut instinct? If you could please expand.
Well, I think there's been a lot of analysis very recently around the projected impact of the EPA regulations on the coal baseload resource in this nation as a whole, and certainly MISO did a fairly thorough analysis of what they expected, and I think there's been several thousand megawatts of coal retirements announced already in the MISO area. Have we gone out and conducted our own study? No, we have not done that, but through MISO, through EEI, through other trade organizations, we certainly pay close attention to those forecasts.
And if you could help us, is there anything specifically within the record that you're aware of right now that points towards what you've just discussed as far as analyses?
I believe the MISO study is in the record.
Right. And
okay. I mean, I believe it is.
I guess moving on, if MDU builds this proposed 88-megawatt CT, will the capital cost of this asset be recovered from the customers?
They would be.
So put it another way, if you have a rate base without the CT and then you have a new rate base with the CT, there's going to be a higher rate base, correct?
Correct.
And as a result, will MDU earn a larger return on this higher rate base?
A larger return? We will earn our regulated or allowed return, I would assume.
Which would be more if the CT weren't part of the rate base, correct?
Which would be more if the CT were part?
We're not.
Please restate your question. I'm not sure I understand.
You're going to receive more money if the CT is included in the rate base. Isn't that correct?
We will receive earnings on that investment, yes.
So shareholders are going to benefit by the building of the CT. Is that correct?
I believe so.
So let's compare this, the building of the CT versus purchasing a PPA. Isn't it in fact that the shareholders are going to make more money by MDU building the CT rather than purchasing, for instance, the energy and capacity from a PPA?
There would be earnings on that investment, so I would say your statement is correct.
So does this provide an incentive for the company to pick its own projects over purchases?
You know what? That doesn't enter into my consideration. We look for the best cost resource to reduce risk to our customers. The more we lean on the market, the riskier it is for our customers in terms of long-term pricing. When we build a resource, for instance, when we built the Miles City turbine 40 years ago, that has continued to serve our customers at a cost that depreciates over time. It provides long-term known value to our customers. I think that's a good thing for our customers.
But if I'm an investor, if I'm an equity shareholder, I'm going to want your company to make more money, correct?
Well, we are a publicly traded company. That's what we do.
So it's one of your objectives to make more money.
It's one of my objective is to serve my customers, our companies.
I'll rephrase it. It's one of MDU's objectives to make more money, correct?
Sure.
Very good. Thank you. If you could now please go to your rebuttal testimony, page 2.
Page 2 rebuttal. That's exhibit 110. 110. Page which? I'm sorry.
Page 2.
2. Thank you. Yep. I'm there.
Thank you. Just one moment. On page 2, could you please refer to lines 1 through 4?
Page 2, lines 1 through 4.
Yep.
Starting, no. Lease cost is not a requirement for issuing an advanced determination of prudence or a certificate of public convenience and necessity. Not all prudent resources are necessarily least cost resources and vice versa. Montana Dakota seeks the best overall value for its customers. I went into line 5 a bit.
Thank you. Now, is it your position that the commission cannot examine the cost of alternatives?
No, certainly not.
Now, I believe it was indicated before, is it your position that proposed resources that are located within North Dakota are afforded a rebuttable presumption of prudence? Is that your understanding?
That's my understanding of the statute, yes.
Now, I guess from the ratepayer's standpoint, I guess our question is, if there's an out-of-state resource that was available but at a significantly lower cost than, for instance, a CT, could that become a basis for rebutting the presumption of this prudence?
If all the costs were included in that, it could. I think it could be. I'm not a lawyer. I don't know that we've tested that in this state.
You understand. I mean, that if there were an out-of-state resource at a lower cost, that it technically could be more prudent than, for instance, this 88 megawatt CT.
If all the costs are included in the analysis.
Well, our question is, I guess, since we've arrived at that conclusion, at what threshold, how much of a lease cost would an out-of-state resource have to be to be able to adequately rebut that presumption?
I don't know what your threshold would be.
But at some level, it would be acceptable in that. Recognize that?
I recognize that there could be a situation where an out-of-state resource, all things considered, may be less costly than an in-state one. I do also believe there are harder to quantify or unquantifiable benefits that need to be considered, and as that's our job as a utility is to understand all of that.
Thank you. If you could please refer now to page 7 of your rebuttal testimony.
I'm there.
Thank you. Well, from a line about lines, I don't think you need to read this, but lines 7 through 20, you discuss the potential repowering of the Heskett 1 unit to a combined cycle type scenario.
I am familiar with it, but let me reread it right now.
Certainly. Just let me know when you've done.
Yep. Thank you.
Yep. Thank you. Did the company analyze this scenario in Aegeus?
No.
What assumptions were made about the retirement of the Heskett 1 unit?
The assumption was made that we may have to retire it at some point in time.
Just one moment. I guess my next question is, in Aegeus, was the Heskett 1 unit assumed to be retired, and if so, when?
I do not believe it was, subject to check with the people that did the modeling.
Thank you. I guess our question is that how is the company aware of whether or not repowering the HESCA 1 unit is better than perhaps an entirely new combined cycle unit?
I don't know that we have specifically done that. However, we have done some preliminary engineering to analyze what the cost would be to repower that. We have a large chunk of what would be a combined cycle resource there that is a significantly depreciated asset that we could continue to use to the benefit of our customers. And if you want more details on that, I'm probably not the one to ask. Mr. Welty might be a better bet for you.
Mr. Welty. Thank you. Just one moment, Your Honor.
Could I?
Please.
And we have no intentions to retire Unit 1 at any point in time in the foreseeable future. So that is, we believe, a good engineering option for us, but nothing that we are penciling out at this moment.
Very good. Thank you. I have no further questions, Your Honor.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco.
My question's related to the IRP modeling and the relationship to the repowering. And so I think that may have been discussed sufficiently unless we get another witness up to talk about it. Thank you.
Questions from the commission. Commissioner Clark.
Thank you for your testimony. And, again, if there are witnesses who are better suited to answer some of these, feel free to deflect them. Could you walk me through the decision-making process, perhaps not so much with regard to selecting a particular resource, but the timing decision of whether to build or not build at this particular point? In other words, to what degree has MDU taken into consideration in its modeling the value of waiting, whether that's a reasonable option in maybe procuring through purchases or through the market for some period of time while more certainty is obtained versus the value of building now and how that's modeled. I know most resource planning models try to take into consideration some sort of balancing or weighing of the build versus wait decision.
So I understand your question to be why did we analyze a self-build at this point in time, given the fact that there's some uncertainty in the markets? Is that correct?
Correct. Or maybe even expanding upon it, not just the idea of self-build, but why build now as opposed to waiting for some period of time.
Okay. Sure. Well, as I'd indicated, with the expiration of, I've said this so many times on this stand, with the expiration of the Antelope Valley contract, the 66 megawatts, it was a long-term contract. It was a great contract. We liked it. We couldn't get Basin to extend it. And the loss of the Big Stone 2 power plant. I mean, we have been looking for capacity for a long time, for many years. And we've got roughly 20% of our capacity at risk. We have three old, I'll admit it, coal plants. We love them. They work well for our customers, but we have to wonder about the longevity of those plants. And so we're trying to, I guess in my mind, the things I think about is what do we build, when do we build it strategically, how does that time with potential retirements, what's the market for labor going to be like? What is the cost of equipment going to be like in the future? What are gas prices going to do? What is capacity on pipelines going to do? How do we leverage the perfect time to build anything? And it's a pretty hard call to make. But all of those things I mentioned go into the equation. You go out for a request for proposal to test the market. What's out there? Well, we got a lot of people to bid in wind. We had a wind nuclear. That would have been cool, but that just wasn't going to work. We had some CTs. We had some combined cycles. We had some expensive stuff. We had some less expensive stuff. We had transmission problems and uncertainty, as you know. All these things came into play. We have some reliability issues and some transmission issues that are unique in this area that we know we're going to have to address and that we know are going to drive costs for our customers in the future. So we looked at all these things. With the passing of the Utility MACT and CSAPR, even though I know that's on administrative hold or whatever, stay right now, these big environmental rules, we see that if people are going to comply with those, including us, we're going to need equipment, we're going to need labor, we're going to need a lot of stuff. There's going to be huge competition for these things. As coal units close, more and more gas turbines are going to be constructed. To hit this market a little bit before we think it's going to get frenzied, we think is a good reason to think hard about building now. Same thing as we heard with the Big Stone 2 AQCS. Same there. Gas price is pretty low. There is available capacity on pipelines to get fuel to this resource now. That's a good thing, and it's not always something we can always count on. So all these things go into our thoughts. They're hard to quantify, some of them, but they're all there.
Okay, and that's, I guess, what my question was. Does it tend to be mostly a qualitative analysis where you're analyzing a number of things, or is there anywhere in the record that you can point me to where there was a kind of a quantified, as best as possible, sort of statistical analysis of, you know, here are different decision points as we move along and different probabilities for what could happen with regard to environmental regulations and how that impacts these decisions about waiting or building, you know, waiting or building now?
Well, we're not quite that granular. We've known for many years we needed capacity. That's a big, easy thing. And so you look – a big, easy thing to know. Mm-hmm. And so you look at that. Do we do statistical analysis of probabilities? I don't.
Questions about the workings of the MISO market, the move towards some sort of resource adequacy construct. Mm-hmm. Would best addressed to you or later to Darcy?
I would deeply appreciate it if you would pitch those to Mr. Nygum.
Got it.
Maybe you're going first.
Could you address a bit the issue of energy efficiency? Mr. Hahn makes in his pre-filed testimony some comments with regard to EE and that the projections for what EE might achieve over the next, I don't remember the exact time frame, maybe until 2030 or something like that, seemed awfully low for MDU, something like 0.23%, which does seem low compared to national averages or even regional ones that you read about. Could you talk a little bit about that and why that number was used and if it is, in your opinion, a low ball or not?
Well, I'm certainly not an energy efficiency expert, but I will say that there's several things that have, you know, impact our, at least our company's emphasis on energy efficiency. The state also, I have not seen a huge push towards energy efficiency in the state. For instance, our building codes, I think, have been somewhat controversial for many years in terms of not being, as some people think, rigorous enough. We have low energy costs. That's a great thing. It's hard to get people to turn off their lights when it's cheap to leave them on. It's hard to get people to conserve when it is inexpensive not to. That's not a reason to increase your energy costs, however. The states around us have had mandates and have done some social engineering to try to push some of this stuff. This is something our state has not chosen to do and our customers don't seem to have a great deal of interest in. However, I see more and more swirly bulbs, and I guess I will more and more in the future. So It's not that we're opposed to that, but, you know, I think the message we've got from our commissions is that they're not interested in us having specific paying for, charging our customers for specific energy efficiency projects. We do have some new DSM projects coming up, which are good. They make sense, and I think our customers will like them.
Okay, thanks. Could you talk about gas deliverability issues with regard to this proposed plant, or is that better directed somewhere else?
Well, I can tell you what I know, and okay. If it's not enough, you can talk to Mr. Moorman.
Sure. If you could just discuss a little bit about how the type of contract that MDU will be entering into to assure gas deliverability and how it relates to how this plant operates, maybe especially as it interacts with the market and when it may be called to start up and so on and so forth.
Well, I don't want to talk about. I mean, it would be called to serve our peaking load on days when we need the peaking energy here. When we have reliability needs, we would run it here. It would not typically produce energy unless it was the cheapest resource on the margin at the time. So it is a peaking resource, would be used on hot days or in unusual circumstances in the market. In my understanding, and it's a very high-level summary, you know, I understand that we can contract with marketers who have firm capacity on existing pipelines with a gas pressure that's sufficient to serve this CT's fairly high-pressure needs. And we have a reservation fee that we will pay that is about a quarter as expensive as going out and getting firm capacity ourselves on that. So we have a reservation fee we pay to reserve our ability to use their firm capacity to bring gas to us.
Okay.
And if you need more than that, I would suggest you talk to Mr. Moorman.
Okay, thanks. And just remind me, the timetable for build on this, how quickly did these
get built
from groundbreaking to...
We'd start construction in 2013, and this would be available, I think, in March of 2015 in time to get it ready for peak.
Okay. Thanks. That's all I have.
Commissioner Kramer.
Thank you. Thank you, Andrea. Remind me, how often does the Miles City turbine run?
Miles City turbine doesn't run that often. It ran quite a bit after the MISO market first got started because they were trying to figure out how it worked. It runs on peak.
With regard to, I'll get to this later. With regard to gas price, well, let me back up. With regard to your testimony along the lines of capturing 20 years of benefit over 50 years, being, you know, the advantage of steel in the ground, as you put it, versus a PPA. You talked about the risk associated with price after the 20 years. How do you calculate the volatility of gas and the risk that runs in terms of the fuel cost? Because clearly this is a resource that, well, assuming all things that we hear about shale and supply are going forward are rosy, we also know the history of gas is very, very volatile. So how do you assure MDU customers of that you've mitigated all the risk with regard to fuel price?
I would never say I would assure that we've mitigated all risk ever. Certainly there is risk with any fuel price, be it coal, be it uranium, be it natural gas. And I've been up here before talking about natural gas as a risky fuel, and it is. But we use it for peaking, use it for relatively few years or hours a year. And we look at the forward curves. We have smart people. We are in the gas business. We have smart people that look at those forward curves and are pretty comfortable in the foreseeable future that we have reasonably priced and available resources.
Okay. Did MDU consider or look into partnering with other G&Ts that are looking at a huge demand growth in the oil patch to see if there was a piece of a larger project that maybe would have made a different fuel source, given the potential scale, some viability.
When you say fuel source, you think fuel type like coal? Well, you know, we've tried darn hard to partner with others to build coal. Hasn't worked out for us.
No.
We've had three different attempts, and it hasn't worked out for us.
No, but I think you'd have to admit that in the last, even the last year, demand has grown dramatically, and potential demand has created a real need that somebody's going to have to meet.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just wondering if how recent those discussions may have been.
I have had no recent discussions with regard to any coal units, no.
There was, I noticed in some of the cross-examination, a bit of a recurring theme, and Commissioner Clark got to it as well, and that is that the desire by the advocates and our staff in general to have more concrete analysis as opposed to what seems to be somewhat instinctive decision-making with regard to resources. Does MDU have a tendency to be a little more instinctive in its investment decisions than perhaps other utilities, or is that just, are they just being sort of a pain? You don't have to answer the second part.
I wouldn't, I assure you, I haven't worked for another utility, so I can't really directly compare that. I certainly talked to my brother in it, in the planning departments of these utilities, and I think other commissions are far harder to work with, and they may, their IRP planning processes may reflect what other commissions demand that this commission has not. We submit IRPs routinely and seek comment, don't usually get a lot. So absent any direction that our IRPs are light, and I think our last IRP was not light, I would not have wanted to drop that one on my foot. I think we do a fair amount of analysis. But that said, at this point in time, there's not a lot of options available to us.
Well, I would admit, and I'll close with this, your utility and others are in this bit of a damned if you do, damned if you don't mm-hmm. situation right now, and I understand that, and I think we all experience the same sort of frustration. So I appreciate your testimony.
Commissioner Cock.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you for your testimony, Andrew. Mm-hmm. I might just go just a little different way and just a couple of questions. When you looked at what you needed, I know you talked about peaking and some other things, but did you ever consider, let's make a 200-megawatt gas plant and sell it back into the market and find other customers in the Northwest that need it, and then we'll sell this power off, and as our needs grow, we'll take it back? And I think that would be something that I would have looked at. I mean, did you ever look at that complete going the other way?
Well, actually, our IRP did say you should build more.
So why don't we build more?
Well, I mean, we could. There's a number of reasons you might not want to do that. One is I don't mind having a little bit on the market. I think that does help some diversity, provide our customers some diversity of supply and pricing. If we built, for instance, a 200-megawatt gas plant, and I don't know what that would have cost to sell to the market, which is not our business model. Our model is not as an IPP to sell into the market. You wouldn't typically be able to sell gas into a primarily coal market.
But help me back from, and then we probably, neither one of us were then working here where we're at now, but isn't that one of the hallmarks? MDU overbuilt things back in the day, and for decades the customers benefited from the overbuild in the 70s and 80s, perhaps?
Well, when you say overbuild, I mean we did build. You know, to get an economy of scale of a coal unit, you build large-ish, and you have customers. And yeah, we did have to grow into some of that, and most companies have done that. It's smart to build a little bit larger.
Isn't there an economy scale for gas plants, though, too? I'm not
There's some economy of scale. But let's also talk about generation diversity and risk of having a lot of generation on one shaft, as we call it. The largest amount of capacity we have at any one resource is about 100 megawatts. That's about 20% of our installed capacity or our demand. And that's fairly comfortable if you have a long outage. These things do break, and they do take some time to fix. If you have 200 megawatts, for instance, on a single shaft, you're at much greater risk of supply disruption, for your customers as you repair that or if that's out of service. So that's one of the things you look at when you balance. You talk about the size that you need. In terms of selling it into the market, again, I'm not sure that you'd have a big market. In terms of moving it west, we don't have the transmission capability of moving it into the Western Interconnect without being very expensive getting across that. So those are some of the things we think about.
Well, I know intuitively, and I just think we should build things bigger sometimes, especially in North Dakota. Mm-hmm. And the company is in a situation now where, like you said, you're in a tough spot. You've got a limited resources that are available. And is there somewhere, maybe Dorsey will talk more about it, where you could give some more data that building 160 megawatts is not as good as what you're doing, something that could show that this is the right size, a little more data behind it?
Well, one of the and I don't know that we necessarily have that. I have to think about it for a bit. But one of the other reasons to build this particular size is it does work very well with that Unit 1 potential repower. Okay. And I see that as a huge plus. I think it's a very elegant thing to be able to do is to continue to use this old plant in a new configuration to continue to use that asset that our customers have paid for.
Do you know of any, and this is somewhere else probably, but the air quality or air permits that would tick in, do they tick in more as this plant gets bigger?
Oh, they certainly would.
So it probably gets harder to get bigger plants built because of the air permits.
It could be, especially where you site it. Now, this is a location with the refinery there and near these urban areas and with the hills around there that air permitting is likely to be complex.
Okay. And I suppose, too, of course, if the size of the plant changes, the size of the delivery system coming into the plant would change.
Well, and the ability to put it onto our existing transmission. The bigger it is, you might need more transmission upgrades. We didn't study that in detail.
And one more time, what is the life cycle you think of this plant? I've heard some numbers, but I don't know if you answered for this particular one.
What do you mean life cycle?
How many years? You said 40 years for some lake-type plants.
Oh, I gave the example of the Williston turbines. They've been in there almost 60 years. You take care of these things, they can last a long, long time. What was our projected, I don't know, at least 40 years.
Okay. Thank you. That was really all I had. Mm-hmm.
Commissioner Clark.
Can you just talk a little bit about what would MDU's options be if the commission declined to endorse this particular project? So, I mean, if we say the Heskett plan doesn't look like it's that hot for us. So what's plan B? Is it buy capacity from the market? Is it look at long-term contracts? What's that next step? Is it rolling brownouts? I mean, give me a sense of
we will try really hard not to have rolling brownouts.
Right.
That's not what we do. We would go back to the market with another RFP and see what was out there and probably get wind and CTs again. That's what I would bet.
Okay. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Commissioner Kramer. Further questions from the commission? Follow-up. Mr. Kuntz.
Thank you, Your Honor. Ms. Stomberg, in some of the questioning by staff, there was a suggestion in the questions that the company may have incentive to bias its modeling in favor of owned resources rather than power purchase agreements or contracts in order to increase rate base and therefore increase the number of dollars returned to shareholders. You recall that questioning?
Yes, I do.
Do each of those owned resources require a corresponding investment by shareholders for that return?
Certainly.
You mentioned the Antelope Valley arrangement. Was that a power purchase agreement or was that an owned resource?
I think that was a contract that morphed over time that I'm not aware of the early years, but that was a PPA.
And how long did that arrangement stay in place?
Oh, I think that was at least 20 years.
And did the company did Montana Dakota seek to extend that contract?
We certainly did.
And were you successful in doing that?
No.
So then what did the company do then to replace that capacity when the Antelope Valley contract expired?
Well, we started planning to see if there were coal resources we could build, for instance, a Big Stone 2-piece, some other resources we were looking at, Gascoyne, but we went out for an RFP
And how did you end up replacing that capacity between the time that the basin contract expired until today?
Well, with PPAs.
And did more than one PPA?
We've had several.
And during that time frame, did you also look at possible ownership scenarios such as combustion turbines?
Yeah.
And you selected power purchase agreements during those time periods. And then you also mentioned demand control. Has the company looked at demand control agreements recently?
Yes. In fact, we just inked a contract for 25 megawatts of demand control resources to be implemented over the next several years.
And that's a contract that with a third party to provide those demand control resources.
Correct. Yep.
And that will reduce, hopefully, the amount of investment the company will have to make in a capacity resource if it works. Is correct?
Yes.
And then you also, I believe, testified that the company still expects to have some reliance on the market for a piece of its capacity in the near future. Is that also correct?
Yes.
There was a question by Commissioner Kramer regarding the fuel risks. Are there fuel risks associated with a PPA?
There can be.
For example, the Illinois proposal, what was the nature of the fuel for that proposal, if you recall?
That's gas.
So the same fuel risk that would be associated with this resource would be associated with the Illinois resource?
Correct.
That's all the questions I have.
Mr. Grumman.
No further questions, Your Honor.
Is Jeff Kotsacko?
I have two. One is, if you're out in the MISO market, the same fuel risk that you've just been talking about with Mr. Kuntz would be associated with the MISO market potentially. Is that correct?
Well, there's a real diversity of fuel types that provide energy in the MISO market. Coal, right. Nuclear, wind, and gas. So I would say it's somewhat mitigated.
Okay. The second question that staff would request, unless it's here somewhere, just point us to it. Would MDU be able to simply list for us the factors considered that are not quantifiable, that were not quantified in the IRP or anywhere else?
Certainly we can do that. I mean, I think it's there, but if you want us to pull it out and clarify it, absolutely.
I think we could use it pulled out in one spot.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Is this, say, to be a late-filed exhibit, Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
That would be fine. They may have it today yet. You know, later today. It's possible or not.
You want to
put together a list, like I said. I think a lot of this
handwritten?
Stuff has been
that's okay.
Discussed in the testimony, but if you right. want kind of a list of things, we can try to put that together during the course of the day or, if not,
well, yes, what we want to be sure that we aren't missing that something we think was not quantified, you know, that we're making a mistake and it is somewhere else. We can make our own list, but we want to be sure it's accurate, so we're asking MDU for the list.
You can see what we can put together.
Yep.
All right, and Council, if it's not prepared to be offered today or otherwise at the close of hearing, then I will rely on Council to make a request for a late-filed exhibit.
That'll be MDU 113, Your Honor.
That's correct. Further questions, Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
No, thank you.
Follow-up from the Commission? Anything further from the Commission? Mr. Kuntz, follow-up?
No.
Mr. Garman, follow-up? Or Grumman? Thank you very much, Ms. Domburg. Mr. Kuntz.
We would call Darcy Nigam. Your Honor, Mr. Nigam has got a fairly long presentation, about 20-some slides. We can do some preliminary stuff, and then I'm not sure what you want for a break, but maybe we want to take a break and so we don't have to interrupt that presentation.
It's a little early, but not much. So let's be in recess for 10 minutes, Mr. Kuntz.
I'll be fine.
10 minutes until 20 after 10 o'clock. All right, we will resume. Mr. Kuntz.
Thank you, Your Honor. We've called Mr. Nigam to the stand.
Mr. Nigam, as you know, your testimony is required to be under oath, and I'm required by law to advise you regarding perjury before administering the oath. Perjury is a false statement of material fact which you do not believe to be true. In North Dakota, perjury is a Class C felony, punishable by a fine up to $5,000, imprisonment for a period of up to 5 years or both. Will you raise your right hand, please? Being advised regarding perjury, Mr. Nigam, do you swear that the testimony which you're about to give in this matter shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Mr. Kuntz.
Thank you, Your Honor. Please state your name.
Darcy John Nigam.
Mr. Nigam, you're employed by Montana Dakota Utilities Co.
Yes.
And you've pre-filed initial rebuttal and corrected testimony, pre-filed testimony in this case?
Correct.
And just for the reference, Mr. Nigam's initial testimony is Exhibit 107. His rebuttal testimony is Exhibit 111, and his corrected testimony is Exhibit 112. And do you have any changes, corrections to that testimony, Mr. Nigam?
I do have some changes.
Okay, can you give those to us at this time?
Sure. The first one is on page 24 of my rebuttal, which is MDU Exhibit 111. Yes. And this would be at the end of line 19.
Okay.
Page 24, the end of line 19, should also include the following, which would be subject to securing a firm transmission service request from MISO back to MDU. Again, that would be at the end of line 19, subject to securing a firm transmission service request with MISO back to MDU.
Any other corrections or additions?
I have one other, which is on page 28
of the same. Okay.
And this would be a change to the trade secret information.
Would you just wait, Mr. Nigam, before proceeding? For persons listening to the Internet stream, the Internet stream will be interrupted as necessary to protect trade secret information. The interruption may be only momentary or may be as long as a few minutes. In any case, as soon as the testimony regarding trade secret information is presented, the Internet stream will continue.
Okay.
You may proceed, Mr. Nigam.
Okay. And this would be in regards to there was a revised Exhibit DJN-3. And so in that, on line 22, the word only should be struck for trade secret, and then the $4 million on line 23 should be replaced with $874,000. And on line 24, the word more should be less.
That completes the trade secret.
All right. You may continue, Mr. Kuntz.
With those corrections, Mr. Nigam, if I were to ask you the questions that appear in Exhibits 107, 111, and 112, would your answers be the same today as they appear in your pre-file testimony?
Yes, they would.
And then you've also prepared PowerPoint slides that have been marked as Exhibit 106 that summarize your pre-file testimony, have you not?
Correct.
And at this time, Your Honor, I would ask Mr. Nigam to provide a summary of his pre-filed and rebuttal and corrected testimony using the PowerPoint slides have been marked as Exhibits 106.
You may proceed, Mr. Nagum.
My summary presentation that I have will talk about a number of points. One, it will show the need that the company has for capacity resources in the future. It will also describe the evaluation process that the company used to determine our future resource plan. I'll also discuss some of the critique that Mr. Richard Hahn had regarding Montana Dakota's modeling process and explain why his comments do not change the selection of the 88-megawatt combustion turbine resource. I'll also discuss in detail the differences between the Illinois combustion turbine proposal and the company's 88-megawatt combustion turbine resource and explain why the Illinois proposal is not a viable and least cost proposal. And then I'll also spend just a little bit of time discussing the effects of the expiration of the WAPA transmission service agreement on December 31st of 2015. Montana Dakota has a need, as we've talked about, for both capacity and energy resources. That's largely driven by our needs today, plus also the forecast that we have for growth for both capacity and on the energy side. In our most recent system forecast that we've put together, the five-year average sales growth is projected to be 3.5% annually for the next 5 years, and the demand growth is forecasted to be 2.5% over the same period on an annual basis. With the potential for increased customer growth in the Bakken formation, we may see these levels of growth be even higher or continue at those levels for an extended period of time. Also noting, this past summer we did set an all-time summer peak of 535 megawatts, which was set on July 29th. If you would compare that peak level versus our forecast that we had in the 2011 Integrated Resource Plan, that's basically the level of demand that we were forecasting to see in 2013. Our capacity need, as we've talked about, in 2015 is projecting a deficit of roughly 149 megawatts, or in MISO's terms, they're planning resource credits, or PRCs. This accounts for about 25% of all our capacity requirements. This is driven by a number of factors. The growth that we've talked about, the expiration of the current capacity purchase agreement that we have with We Energies, which expires in May of 2015. Going back to the expiration of the Antelope Valley 66-megawatt capacity and energy purchase agreement that the company benefited from for a number of years, expired in November of 2006. As we've talked about, we've been replacing that with purchase capacity ever since. And the last major capacity resource addition that the company has made is the Glendive Unit 2, which was completed in 2003. That also is a gas turbine resource. This is a graph from our integrated resource plan that basically shows at the time of the plan what we were looking at as far as customer load, which ends up being the quantities in blue as we see increasing, and then also the company's capacity resources that either we owned or had contracted. We end up seeing in 2014 that basically we end up with the deficits created in 2015 for the summer season driven by the expiration of the We Energies purchase capacity agreement. As part of our analysis that we had in the 2011 Integrated Resource Plan, we went out for a request for proposals looking at other alternatives that were available from others and in the market. This process was started in June of 2010, largely completed and analyzed through the fall of 2010, and the bids that were part of that were valid through the end of December of 2010. As part of that request for proposal, the company did a solicitation for all resources beginning in June of 2015, so it wasn't just limited to a fuel type. We also did solicit demand response conservation type programs. From that, we received a total of 8 responses to that. 3 of those were for wind resources. 1 was a combination of a wind and a nuclear resource. We received proposals from 2 bidders for combustion turbine resources, either being of the simple cycle combustion turbines type of format or a combined cycle combustion turbine format. We also had 1 entity that bid their wholesale tariff rate to us, And we also did receive a response for one demand response program. As a part of the screening that we initially did on those proposals, we ended up having three of them that were shown to be potentials for least cost. The demand response program itself, we ended up signing a contract with a third party as far as the implementation of that program. And I'll talk in detail a little more as far as on a North Dakota wind proposal that we received and also a proposal for an Illinois combustion turbine proposal, why we considered those to not be viable and had concerns as far as what the risks that were associated with them. One of the things we've noted as far as in this request for proposal and also the prior one that we had to it is the level of uncertainty that exists particularly from our neighboring utilities regarding their availability of excess capacity that they may have or resources and at least their inability to really be able to offer those or bid those to us as far as potential resources in the future. Some of the alternatives that we considered as far as self-built options included a 43 megawatt and an 88 megawatt combustion turbine resource, a combined cycle combustion turbine resource of 140 megawatts in size. We looked at wind generation with production tax credits and without production tax credits after 2012. We also looked at a generic coal-fired generation option. We had our own company demand response and energy efficiency programs, and then also a part of the analysis that we had at the timing of the 2011 integrated resource plan was the Big Stone air quality control system equipment as a modeled option. So this is the one we had modeled basically the retirement of the existing Big Stone plant, and the model basically had to choose the addition of the additional air control equipment as far as being viable as compared to other options that were available. From the outcome of our 2011 integrated resource plan, we had a number of actions that were part of our two-year action plan. One of those was to pursue the Big Stone air quality control project. The other one was to enter into contract negotiations on a 25-megawatt commercial and industrial demand response program. We have signed that agreement, and also is the construction of an 88-megawatt combustion turbine resource to be located at Heskett Station. Now, that doesn't get us all the way to fulfilling our needs for our 149 megawatts. You know, in the short term, we do have the ability to either purchase capacity from the MISO capacity auction or through bilateral agreements, at least on a short-term basis, that we feel are available. The other one that we're looking at doing as far as to look out for the deficit that we're still seeing and beyond at 2015 and beyond is the issuance of another request for proposals at 2012. Mr. Richard Hahn had a few comments that he had made regarding some of our modeling assumptions that were a part of the modeling that we did that used our resource expansion planning model, which we end up calling a GIS as far as an acronym. One of those dealt with the treatment as far as the allowance for funding used during construction. One of the comments that was in there is we didn't include that for self-build, and that ends up being true when we looked at the 88-megawatt resource and it was an oversight. Our practice is that basically the prices that we put in the model as resources available include AFUDC. That way the model doesn't have to do cash flows and take other sorts of financing additions that it makes to those costs. On the particular one for the resource for the 88 megawatt, we had done a separate buildup for that and overlooked that it was missing AFUDC in that buildup. And so when we ended up putting that number in the model, it didn't include AFUDC just for that particular resource. Another issue that was pointed out was the incremental cost for a combined cycle resource. The way we ended up modeling a combined cycle resource is that it was modeled at a total of 140 megawatts in size. In order to have a combined cycle resource, you need to have a simple cycle gas turbine. So something ends up supplying the heat that you can then use as far as a heat recovery boiler and a steam turbine. So the 140 megawatt resource is really combined with the potential heat or heat source you get from the 88-megawatt combustion turbine resource. When we developed the model as far as how this was picked, there's two different resources. One's the simple cycle resource, and then if that's selected, the model can basically choose to add the combined cycle to that resource either at the same point in time or at a future point in time. And we developed that, the cost for that incremental, it was a part of our 2009 integrated resource plan. And when we ended up creating the 2011, we used a lot of the basis that we had in the 2009 IRP. This particular one, we didn't change the pricing to reflect the increased cost for the 88 megawatt resource. And so one of the issues we had with this particular one, it understated, or actually the way the model was set up, it overstated the cost of what a combined cycle resource would be. For this particular point, we went back and basically made an adjustment to the model based upon Mr. Hahn's concerns. It didn't change any of the outcomes or selections of resource in the resource plan. One of the other questions was the number of available combined cycle resources. In the model, we included the optionality of having one combined cycle resource, and because the model doesn't pick more than one, we didn't put in more than one. And one of the reasons for doing that is the more options you put in the model, it basically causes it more time to basically do its analysis because it has to then basically look at, do I add one, do I add two, all the additional resources every time it goes through every planning year. So it basically cuts down the number of model iterations and the runtime, has no effect as far as on the outcome of what the model was. One of the other comments was around the cost of self-built wind. And Mr. Hahn suggested that we should have used a number closer to $1,750 per kW as far as the installed cost of wind. We ended up using a number that was closer to what our experience has been with some of our recently completed projects. You know, the $1,750 per kilowatt number is probably closer as far as in today's dollars, but I don't think it's a reflection of what the long-term cost is. Demand is suppressed today based upon there's fewer projects being built because of the uncertainty of the production tax credits, and there also is a surplus amount of turbines that are available that folks have purchased or secured that they basically have in the market. Another one was the comment around the expiration of the federal production tax credits. In that one, we had assumed the production tax credits would expire at the end of 2012, as they're currently slated to do. There is a possibility those could be extended. We didn't model that. If we take a look at what's known and measurable, they're set to expire. We would end up thinking if they were extended, it would probably be at a lower funding level than what currently is there. One of the other points in our modeling that Mr. Hahn pointed out and caught is another issuance we had of a discrepancy. When we initially modeled a purchased wind energy option in our modeling, it had the availability to purchase some capacity off that unit as well. And so the model didn't pick that capacity portion as far as in the model, so we turned it into an energy-only resource to basically let it be selected in either 2015 or 2020 blocks. In doing that, we forgot to take the cost out of the model that it had for a fixed O&M cost is how we would have modeled the capacity. When we ended up removing that fixed O&M portion associated with that purchase energy proposal, didn't make any changes as far as in the selections of resources in the modeling. Another comment dealt with the equivalent forced outage rate, or the EFOR as it's listed for the 43 megawatt combustion turbine. In MISO's in their capacity construct they have today, or their Module E, you basically take the amount of potential capacity that you would get through a summer-type urge test, and you would apply a forced outage rate to that, either that you've demonstrated or that you actually, if it's a new unit, you basically get, you apply a value that basically MISO develops for similar-type classes and sizes of machines. We ended up using the value for the 43-megawatt combustion turbine that MISO had developed for that size resource rather than picking our own number, and we just assumed that would continue for the life of the project. We ended up making a change where we had lowered that number to a value that Mr. Hahn suggested, which was equivalent to what the 88-megawatt combustion turbine had in MISO's same table for an equivalent forced outage rate, and it didn't change the selection of the 43-megawatt turbines over the 88 that was selected, and all that it really did is cause the staggering of the selection of the 43-megawatt resources in future years, basically pushed them back a little bit. Another point that there was a question about changing the energy cost for the Calpine resource. That was another combustion turbine resource that was received. As a part of that in our modeling, we had created what an energy price was associated with that. We had used some numbers that we thought were more equivalent to run times that we've seen on combustion turbines, particularly how they're operated in the Dakotas here. And Mr. Hahn suggested that we use a lower number, which would have been based upon some assumptions that were given to us from Calpine. When we ended up making those adjustments, it didn't make any changes as far as to the model selection. There also is the question about the high number of 43 megawatt combustion turbines that are selected. And that really gets back to a function of the model itself on a lease cost. You know, it's trying to come up with the best solution to meet both the capacity and energy need. And that particular resource, after the selection of the 88 megawatt resource, really provides from what's available, you know, the best and most economical way to meet our growing capacity and energy requirements. Mr. Hahn also suggested there were a couple other additional modeling runs that we should have considered. One of those would be a high coal retirement. I did make some comments as far as in my rebuttal on that. In that particular case, which is one of the ones that MISO is studying with some of the EPA impacts, you know, there certainly is a potential for a significant amount of coal retirement. If that would happen or occur, we would end up seeing at least the capacity reserve margins within MISO would drop, would basically cause the price of what capacity is available to go up. We would end up seeing that natural gas turbines would set the marginal cost for energy a greater percentage of the time. And what that would really do was lead us more in the selection of a combined cycle type resource because we see higher energy prices. And in doing that, it would end up selecting the 88 megawatt resource at Heskett Station basically to make that configuration available. Another one would end up being on the production tax credit extension. If that would occur, we had done some modeling, additional modeling on that, as Mr. Hahn had suggested. If the PTCs are extended, we end up seeing particularly, I think it would continue to drive through at least the competition of wind as a price taker as it exists in the energy markets, which really kind of keeps gas off the margin and keeps pricing down. It's an energy-only resource, so it doesn't meet our capacity need, and it really drives us back into installing the lowest cost capacity resource, which gets us back to the 88 megawatt resource as far as what the model would look at. So Mr. Hahn provided a number of comments as far as on our GS modeling, going through and looking at those with some additional runs, taking a look and seeing the effect, some of the things that he had suggested, and we did make some changes to our modeling. In our mind, it didn't change the selection of the 88 megawatt combustion turbine resource in 2015. Just a note to make as far as our modeling and what it shows for what others modeling would basically select for capacity and energy resource, it's very similar. Today, if you would go out, how do you meet your capacity needs? It's really through combustion turbines is where we're at today, really based upon what's available from a technology-wise and also uncertainty as far as on the permitting side. On the energy side, that energy comes from either combustion turbines and or wind as far as with production tax credits being extended. So I think our model, as far as what it's showing, basically responds in a manner that's similar to what others are seeing. Also, in both the 2009 and 2011 integrated resource plans that we developed, both resource plans showed the selection of a combustion turbine resources in 2015. This is just a little bit of a side-by-side, some of the outcomes of what comes in a GIS. The first column that's here basically shows what we had in our base case in our integrated resource plan. Mr. Hahn had suggested that we make some additional changes for some additional modeling runs. We did those. That basically put back in the inclusion of the Illinois combustion turbine resource and also the North Dakota wind proposal. In doing both those resources were selected as part of the least cost plan in 2015. There was also an additional modeling run that was made to basically remove those resources, keeping all the other assumptions in place, which basically continued to select the 43 megawatt combustion turbine and the 88 megawatt combustion turbine at Heskett Station, basically in 2015. The other one, as a note on those same changes, we ended up seeing based upon wind at $1,750 a kilowatt and also the extension of the production tax credits beyond 2012 assumption, basically was the addition of an additional 120 megawatts of wind for the company to build and own in 2011. We end up looking in the out years, basically we keep seeing the same thing. We just see the addition of combustion turbines that we end up seeing at various years. I'll talk a little more later. There was the comment that Mr. Hahn also made around the difference in net present values between the various scenarios of showing what the additional cost was, particularly of the Illinois proposal. And in doing that, I'll explain why that's not a good measure at a little bit later. I want to spend a little bit of time talking about this North Dakota wind proposal that came out of our request for proposal that was identified as a potential least cost resource as it was bid in the RFP. That proposal itself was an energy-only resource. There was no capacity that it provided. It was a 150-megawatt project, which was located near Hettinger to be connected to our system. When we looked at this proposal initially, if we go back to and talk about the timing for the request for proposal, which was issued in June of 2010, the bids were received in the fall, and we kind of got through the short list before the end of the year. In October of 2010, MISO had completed a study looking at system impacts and that this project was included in as part of a larger study, and it was showing network upgrades that were very significant that for this particular project that would have been in the neighborhood of several hundred millions of dollars for network upgrades. And looking at that, we considered that piece by itself would have made it more expensive than another proposal that we did end up modeling, which was for another wind project that's built and connected to our system and has the benefits of the production tax credits. Also, when we look at the Hettinger area, it isn't typically an area that we would go and look at building a wind project, particularly one that's of this size. One of the concerns ends up being that particular area down there, we don't have a lot of load and we're heavily connected with WAPA down there. One of the concerns with that area is any flows out of Hettinger want to go south, and it basically pushes flows down onto the WAPA IS system in South Dakota. And we also have a limited amount of transmission capabilities that we have on that line. We have rights right now to 50 megawatts that go on that 230 line that's down in the Hettinger area. So in looking at the potential for costs for the network upgrades at the time, and also looking at the potential impacts that could also be added for costs based upon flows onto the WAPA integrated system or use of their facilities, we considered this proposal to be higher cost than the other purchased wind energy option that we did have in the Aegeus modeling. Like I said, that other project was for a project that was built and connected to our system today. Next, I want to talk about another proposal we'll refer to as the Illinois proposal, which is a 176-megawatt simple-cycle combustion turbine project. It's located along the border between Illinois and Indiana. As bid, this project offered to us either 88 megawatts or 176 megawatts. There's four turbines that are part of the site, so they were willing to offer us either two or four turbines. And as bid, it had a 20-year power purchase agreement for a term to it. We did not consider this a viable long-term resource for a number of points. One, based upon the length of the term of the agreement and also with MISO's development of their new resource adequacy construct, we were concerned with the ability of how we could use this particular resource, as we talk about in a little bit, based upon the zonal concept that MISO has moved towards as far as resource adequacy. This resource provides us no local reliability benefits to our system. It's an off-system resource. It's located elsewhere. Those reliability benefits basically end up being the energy supply it can make. It ends up providing voltage support. And the other thing for reliability, you end up with the ability to mitigate transmission outages or also congestion. Those are things a resource in Illinois would not provide to our system. This is also an energy resource, basically located three states away from us. It's almost like we would have our own independent power project that we would have in another state. it would dispatch based upon the needs within MISO, but really over within that Indiana-Illinois area, and provide services off to customers in Indiana and Illinois. We also had concerns as far as potential changes or impacts with MISO membership. Past couple of years, there have been a few entities between us and this resource that have talked about potential withdrawals from MISO. And also, this is kind of on the eve a little bit when Duke and First Energy had announced they're leaving a MISO, and it was kind of up in the air if that was a trend that was going to continue or not. If you end up losing membership within MISO where it affects that path, now it really gets back into how could you use that resource and still be able to get that capacity credit that's located three states away all the way back to serve our customers. And the other one is there's also impacts on further changes that are potential as far as with MISO's resource adequacy rules. Just a year ago, when we entered into the We Energies contract, basically capacity within MISO was deliverable across the entire footprint. There was nothing about zones, or there was really no concerns as far as if you'd be able to use capacity that would be located, like in the case of We Energies in Wisconsin or over in Indiana, Illinois, it would all just work as a part of the process. Now we end up creating separate zones and separate studies and separate auction prices. And there is the ability to basically, as we saw within a year, that MISO could further change those rules that would basically affect how we could use this particular resource. So it really gets back into what's the true cost of this proposal. As we look over the horizon, what are the potentials? What are the additional things that could be added? As we modeled this in our resource, we modeled it as bid. We didn't go through and try to quantify, put additional dollars on, or say these are additional things that would be considered. Mr. Hahn did offer a side-by-side comparison. As we go into that, we'll try to quantify some of the additional changes or suggestions to make to show maybe how we end up accounting for some of the potential true costs that could be associated with this proposal. MISO's resource adequacy construct, or how they end up changing their capacity market or how everybody deals with their capacity needs, was filed with FERC on July 7th of 2011. That process is currently on hold just because of the large number of comments, so it's kind of unknown when FERC is going to rule on this. The current intent is that it begins with the planning year 2013-14, so this would be June of 2013 through May of 2014 planning year is when it would begin. This includes a mandatory one-year auction process, basically looking at all load and capacity within MISO. And also creates a new concept, which is the local resource zones. So instead of this capacity being universally deliverable, or if you had capacity credits anywhere in the footprint of MISO that you could use them to serve any load within MISO, now it has more of this zonal resource zone concept. And in doing that, there is a mandatory auction and then a separate auction clearing price that does exist for each local resource zone. This is a map that currently exists that shows, as MISO proposed their local resource zones, that shows the seven zones. And they're kind of broken along traditional service territory lines and also natural breaks kind of in the system as far as boundaries with lakes and rivers and other sorts of things. Montana, Dakota obviously is located in this zone one. It's a fairly large, broad zone. The resource we're talking about on this Illinois proposal is located on the border down here. When MISO looks at zones, and what they're looking at is how does congestion, how do constraints, how is the transmission system used, and saying that capacity is not universally deliverable. And so what MISO does is they look at each zone and they look at the amount of capacity and also generation in each zone. And then they'll basically look at the ties between zones to see how much you can export and import in. And then based upon the requirements that you need, you make the determination, is the zone deficit itself, that basically or does it have an excess amount of resources? And then you can basically use that to decide if capacity in one zone, is it able to be, in a sense, from a pricing standpoint, portable to the next zone, or basically is there a limitation? And so each of these zones will basically do their own study to look at capacity generation and the transfer capabilities between zones. If we look at zone one and we look where this resource is located, there ends up being two zones we basically have to jump across as far as import-export capabilities go. One of the last things that MISO added because of a lot of concerns that stakeholders had in the spring of 2011, they looked at more of the concept of self-scheduling and opting out, and ultimately they had the creation of this fixed resource adequacy plan. And some of that dealt with issues more on PJM and minimum offering prices and other concepts that folks had, that if they had a capacity resource and there was an excess amount of capacity in their zone to their load, they may not be able to get fully hedged or priced within their own zone. So MISO came up with this fixed resource adequacy plan, where basically if you'd put one of these together on an annual basis, you basically would show within your zone how you meet your capacity, where your capacity comes to meet your load, plus also your planning reserve margins. And you also had the ability to have a few hedging mechanisms. If you didn't have your resources within the same zone, some of those concepts ended up being opt-out provisions, self-scheduling provisions, and also this new term of a grandmothered agreement. We kind of kicked around a little bit, where did grandmother agreements come from? There actually is another term for grandfathered agreements, as it deals with transmission service agreements and the tariff, so I think they picked grandmothers this time. But on the ability to opt out of a fixed resource adequacy plan, this is really in the case where you would have, in the case of the Illinois proposal, capacity credits in a different zone and load that you have in a different zone, or LRZ. There are some ways, at least, that you can financially hedge across those. One ends up being if you would build transmission across one of those zonal boundaries that would increase the import-export capability, you would be able to get credit for that amount of additional transfer capability. Basically uses a pricing hedging mechanism. The other one that's in there is self-scheduling, and that really only applies if you have load and capacity resources available in the same zone. So basically you could just bid everything in as zero and be a price taker. So kind of like the energy market. Whatever energy pays to the generators, the load basically pays the same thing. So it should net out. You shouldn't have you shouldn't be in a negative position. And then there's this concept of a grandmothered agreement. So knowing that people had historical resources that were located in different zones, there was the concept of you could have a grandmothered agreement if you had entered into a power purchase agreement or ownership in a resource prior to July 15th of 2011, and you had a transmission service request that would go from that resource back to the zone where you want to use those credits. In the case of the Illinois proposal, none of these provisions would have applied unless we would have tried to go out and get a transmission service agreement for the Illinois proposal and would have assigned the agreement prior to July 15th of 2011. That ends up being a risk, too, because you still don't know what the rules are. I mean, you could make a pretty substantial financial position, not know what the rules are, they could change. And the other one is if you get a transmission service request to have a grandmothered agreement, it comes at a cost that is quantifiable because you end up paying as far as the MISO tariff rate for that transmission service request. So getting back again to this map, which at least shows the zones, and one of the concerns is typically around the zones, that if you have an auction occurs in a zone like Zone 1, and if Zone 1 is deficient capacity resources or its auction price is higher than what it would be in another zone, our capacity credits from a proposal like in Illinois would get paid the auction clearing price in Illinois. Our load ends up paying the auction clearing price if we're short based upon North Dakota. So potentially it exists that there's a shortage of capacity that exists in Zone 1 that we could pay something close to the cost of a new entry or cone. The MISO calculates basically for the cost of a new combustion turbine, simple cycle, or combined cycle. And if you're in a zone where there's an excess, this cost could be near zero. So one of the concerns is that basically if there's an excess in Zone 4, the market would basically pay zero if everybody self-schedules for their capacity requirements in Zone 4. If we're deficient over in Zone 1, we could end up having to pay the cost of cone or cost of new entry in Zone 1. Therefore, we wouldn't be able to fully use these credits to serve our customers' load because they're really just serving those requirements that are really in Indiana. A little bit on excess capacity, because it does kind of matter with excess capacity what sort of export and import capabilities you'd have between zones. MISO currently is forecasting, this comes out of one of their EPA impact analysis studies they did, that with no unit retirements, certainly there's adequate capacity reserve margins continue as far as for the foreseeable future. Two scenarios are out there that MISO looked at as far as coal retirements, either a 3,000 gigawatt coal retirement or a 13,000 gigawatt coal retirement. This particular one, they're actually currently in MISO's attachment Y process. There's actually 2,500 megawatts of resources, largely coal, that are set out there for retirement. So even today, this is basically the starting place of where we're at, because we're already seeing the onset of the unit retirement pieces. With potential environmental regulations, there is a potential to see a much significant change as far as in the excess capacity that exists within MISO due to unit retirements. If we look at 2015, if we get into this high case, we end up seeing where the reserve margins are below the 15% threshold. So we would basically see deficits that exist as early as 2015 when we end up needing capacity resources. This is another just illustration from MISO's Supply Adequacy Working Group on June 9th of this year, looking at zones and as far as generation and load, if there's an excess, where is it? Well, it's not in zone one. If we take a look at the load that's in there, we see it's actually the only zone that's out there that's deficient resources within it. So basically, zone one has to get requirements from other zones. The other zones all have an excess. Where it all exists is actually off into the eastern part and the central part. So the cost adders, as far as looking at customer impacts with the Illinois proposal, we talked about no local reliability benefits that it provides here in our service territory. There's the additional cost for a MISO transmission service request from Illinois to North Dakota if we would have tried to have gotten this agreement as a grandmothered agreement. I'll also talk in a little bit as far as our relationship with WAPA and the integrated system transmission charges that basically we could potentially occur in not being able to offset with the unit that would be connected to our system. One of the other ones, it's a resource that's located in Illinois. And so that's where its pricing node is paid as far as what's the energy price in Illinois, not what our load pays in North Dakota. So one way to look at this is it's really just strictly just a capacity purchases we're getting. And I'll show that in the side-by-side. The other one is through the lack of benefits associated with on-system resources that Ms. Stomberg talked about. A resource located at Heskett Station would provide us with improved system reliability. It serves load on our system. It provides voltage support. It also can be used to mitigate transmission outages or congestion on the system. It provides us with synergies and opportunities with Heskett Station. We end up seeing the long-term benefits that we receive of ownership of resources. I'll talk next about the avoidance of some WAPA transmission charges that we're also looking at seeing beginning at the end of 2015. The other one, it reduces our reliance on capacity purchases from other, from what potentially could be 25% down to 6% when it's coupled with the new demand response program in 2015. And it's also a cost-effective resource compared to other alternatives that we have. Montana, Dakota has a long history with Western Area Power Administration. We're very highly connected to their system, as I'll show you. We have an historical transmission service agreement with them that expires the end of 2015. I think it's one of the few remaining grandfathered agreements that they have left as far as on their system. This has provided benefits to both MDU and WAPA customers over the years by basically providing sharing of transmission facilities between our companies. Post the expiration of this agreement, so at the end of 2015, we'll be required to take network transmission service from Western Area Power Administration and the integrated system for services that we're not able to serve from our own facilities or from MISO facilities. So what that ends up meaning is rather than avoidance of cost that we've had on transmission service because we've had a sharing agreement, now we'll be paying the WAPA tariff for service that we take from them. And one of the ways to avoid needing to take service is either you have sufficient transmission facilities or you could use generation to basically offset the need to rely on WAPA's transmission. And this is a process we've discussed with them already. We're actually taking this type of transmission service from them in parts of our service territory because our loads are in and above the levels that were specified in the transmission service agreement. So from a standpoint, they said you're frozen at these levels that you had forecasted in one of the appendix. Anything above that, if you don't have sufficient facilities, you have to take out transmission service. This is a map that shows regional transmission, and we look in the area. So it's those facilities that are 115 kV and above. A little bit of colors. Either you have the yellow facilities that are the WAPA, integrated system facilities. There are the green facilities that are jointly owned. This is the Coyote 345 line. And then you have the blue facilities, a little hard to see, but those end up being the MISO facilities that are regional transmission in the area. If we overlay our service territory map, we'll see we're primarily out on the western edge of this map, and there's a lot of yellow that exists. If we take out all of the WAPA transmission in the area, we'll end up seeing as far as the vast amount of our service territory basically is disconnected. That there is no path from facilities that we own, 115 kV and above, that we can get back and serve our customers without reliance on WAPA and their system. From a note here, if we look at number of connections, these are transmission interconnection points that we have with others, we have three connections with Otter Tail. One of them is down at Ellendale, one of them is at Heskett, and the other one is at Coyote Station, are our three connections that we have with MISO. We have 35 connections with the WAPA and Basin Transmission System. I want to go back to just a little bit on the side-by-side comparison I showed you before. The first column, the base case of the integrated resource plan, and also the additional cases that were requested by LACAPRA, the inclusion of the Illinois combustion turbine in the North Dakota wind project, as well as some other adjustments that we had been requested to make to the model. These are the same slides that we had from the previous one. One of the things that kind of jumps out and is very stark to look at is the dollar value delta that you end up seeing on the net present value between the scenarios. And you end up seeing a dollar value deltas either with and without the Illinois combustion turbine proposal and the North Dakota wind project that basically says that this configuration could be almost $300 million of a cost savings that it could provide if we would just go and exclude these two resources. And one of the concerns with looking at Aegeus in the modeling, in this case, to look at this, is Aegeus picks resources over a 20-year period, and then basically it extends those costs out over 50 years. So if you added a resource in year 20, rather than the model only seeing that cost and taking that cost impact in the first year, it extends it out over a 30-year life. So if you add a large capital resource in the last of the modeling years, it basically will continue those costs so you can see how those long-term benefits are received. One of the anomalies that happens with the 20-year power purchase agreement is that it expires after that 20-year study period. So when the model sees that and gets to year 25 and that resource has expired, all the model can do is basically assume there's another resource that has that same cost and terms that it replaces it with. So that 20-year proposal really turns into a 45-year proposal over the 50 years of study. So the comparison between these as a dollar value delta between the value that a resource in Illinois could provide over the Heskett resource is not, in my mind, a valid number for a comparison. We did a separate additional case that we looked at, which used the same changes to the model that Mr. Hahn and LaCapra had suggested. We removed the Illinois combustion turbines, and basically we assumed that there was no production tax credits or no wind. The North Dakota wind project was also removed. That way we tried to really get back to is if we just took from our base case, made the other changes except for the wind and the Illinois proposal, what's the dollar value that we would start with from a net present value? If you look at that number, it compares very close to where our original base was. And then we basically allowed the model to go back and select as the only additional resource, the Illinois combustion turbine project, and basically gave it a 15-year term on the power purchase agreement. That way it had to replace that resource in the last year of the study year. So that way you could basically see this effect that we're talking about as far as the modeling and as far as how the model can basically has almost an anomaly as it deals with a power purchase agreement replacement after the 20-year study period. If you look at that, we end up seeing the dollar value delta between those scenarios is down to something that's like $59 million instead of $300 million. This does not include any of the additional costs to the Illinois combustion turbine proposal that are potentially impacts, either as we talk about the WAPA transmission service agreement coming up, or as if you had to take out a transmission service request from MISO. Let me go back this way. Judge Wald, the next portion of my slide is a confidential or sensitive information.
All right, just a moment, please. For those who may be listening to the stream on the internet stream will be interrupted, only momentarily, but in any event, as long as Mr. Nigam's testimony concerning trade secrets lasts perhaps several minutes, and it will then resume when his testimony concerning trade secrets is completed. You may proceed, Mr. Nigam.
Okay. And this is the last slide that I have. Mr. Hahn and his direct testimony had produced a side-by-side comparison, which I think is really a better way to look at the cost differences than what the Aegeus modeling uses. Because we're really looking then at just the same type of support that a resource in Illinois could provide to a resource that's located at Heskett Station. There's a few changes we ended up making as far as to some of the assumptions that Mr. Hahn had. One is his analysis had looked at 176 megawatts from the Illinois proposal, and we're only looking to build an 88-megawatt combustion turbine. So we reduced the analysis to 88 megawatts because that's really what we're looking at in this particular hearing that we have. The other one is we extended the modeling years out. Mr. Hahn had used a 16-year period. We increased that to 20 years, which would be the term of the power purchase agreement as it was bid. One of the other changes we had made was Mr. Hahn had used in his analysis fuel and variable O&M. I think from looking at this proposal and where it's located, there may be some differences in energy prices. It may dispatch in Illinois differently than it does in North Dakota, but it's really a capacity resource. And so rather than to look at fuel and variable O&M and effects that you may have from a resource three states away, said let's just look at this to meet our capacity need. So we took out the fuel and the variable O&M components. The fixed O&M numbers are as bid. The demand numbers are as bid as far as in the Illinois proposal. One thing that we included is we talked about the WAPA transmission system. And as we said, we're looking at having to incur additional transmission costs from the WAPA tariff come January of 2016. A resource located on our system could be used to offset or show that we have sufficient facilities and we're not dependent upon the WAPA transmission system as much as we saw in that map. We've actually done some of those studies to look at some of what those effects are. The last one we did was almost back in 2009. What this assumption is saying is that we could basically be able to use this resource, 88 megawatts, and looking at the Bismarck-Mandan area and multiplying it by the WAPA tariff rate for what their network transmission service. It's about the equivalent of their firm point-to-point rate, which is $2.95 today. And basically, per kW month, multiplying that by 12 to get $1 per kW per year for transmission service, and then escalating it at 3%. And that's where this column comes from. That there is that potential to be able to use that resource to avoid this level of transmission service on the WAPA IS. Comparatively, we ended up using the fixed O&M numbers that we had developed for our model. We did make a change in the carrying charges. We had noticed some different numbers for debt that we had used between what was used in Aegeus and also what we had used as far as in some financial revenue requirement cost that basically was around our debt. And initially, we had used a 7% debt, which would be closer to what our historical and embedded debt is. If we look at current long-term debt costs today, they're probably more in the 4 and 4.5%. When we looked at what we used inside our GIS modeling or resource planning modeling, we used 4.4%. So we made that adjustment as well, and which also changed the discount rate. So if we do this analysis looking at really the cost to purchase capacity from this Illinois proposal, our fixed O&M and our carrying costs, so not looking at the runtime on the unit, and we add in the WAPA transmission service costs, we end up seeing on a total expenditure basis that the Heskett resource is a less expensive and also on a net present value basis by $874,000.
That completes Mr. Nagams.
Just a moment, please, Mr. Kurtz. All right, Mr. Kuntz.
That completes Mr. Nagel's presentation. He's available for cross-examination.
Mr. Grumman, when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Nagel, do you have your direct and, I guess, for that matter, all of your testimony in front of you available?
Yes, I do.
Thank you. I'd like you to first proceed to page 5 of your direct testimony.
It'd be helpful for me. Perhaps the rest of the commission, if it could be referred to when we move between testimonies by the exhibit or tab number that's
certainly
provided, that would be great. Thank you.
MDU 111.
Thank you.
The direct is 107.
Is it? Oh, I stand corrected, 107. Thank you.
Okay.
Lines 7 through 14. You could review that.
Which page was that again?
Page 5, MDU 107.
I've reviewed it.
Thank you. I'm just, are the commissioners ready? Or okay, thank you. Are you, in your testimony there from lines 7 through 14 on page 5, that's what you're referring to is 176 megawatt Illinois CT or the Tilden project, is that correct?
Correct.
Now, you indicate as part of your analysis that part of the reason why this Tilden proposal was not viable is because it attained a 20-year term period, is that correct? And, of course, that it was located 3 states away.
Correct.
What was your specific concern about the 20-year term?
The concern would end up being how it would be used or if it would be even viable as part of MISO's resource adequacy being such a large distance away from our service territory.
Did you consider asking for something shorter?
We did not.
And why not?
I guess that wasn't part of our analysis. We had looked as it was bid, and so we looked at that. I think the issues as far as deliverability of capacity or how it would fall into MISO's market. Certainly at the timing of this analysis, you know, MISO was certainly well in the middle of a lot of stakeholder comments and concerns with resource adequacy. And so what I talked about is how the final proposal looks like that they filed with FERC. It was largely different at that point. And as far as there wasn't anything that dealt with any ability to self-schedule, any sorts of things that dealt with a lot of the details they put together. So not knowing how MISO was going to allow the treatment or be able to use particularly a resource that far away really had a lot of concerns of not being able to know what the rules were going to be.
Proceeding on to the fact that this Illinois Tilden proposal is 3 states away, could you please just reiterate your specific concerns in that regard?
Being 3 states away, it's not connected to our service territory. I mean, historically, prior to MISO's capacity construct that it has, in order to be able to use a resource that would be off your system, you'd have to get a transmission service request to basically go and to be able to show that that resource is deliverable back. It's kind of one of the things that exists within MISO's current process is you can get a transmission service request or you may not need one. It kind of depends. And so it's kind of up in the air a little bit. And so the other one with 3 states away is the resource dispatches to to basically meet the needs of customers someplace else. It doesn't dispatch to meet our customers' needs that we have in our service territory.
Now, concerning these deliverability concerns that you just spoke about, did you perform any studies or analyses to evaluate that potential deliverability issues?
Well, there's two parts to it. One, there's the question, if you put in for a transmission service request and the study was done, is it available or are there upgrades that are required? The other one that's a part of that is if you are able to get a transmission service request, it comes at a cost. And so when we look at, as in the case of the WAPA edition we had on the side-by-side, that's $2.95 a kW month. If you'd get a transmission service request, you'll pay the MISO Schedule 7. It's their firm point-to-point transmission rate to bring that back. That rate's currently $2.44. So if you would go off and study that to get that sort of service or be able to designate that path exists, it comes at a cost.
And I certainly don't. Your knowledge of these deliverability concerns, I guess my statement is, has this been reiterated in a memorandum or something like that in that regard? Has it been formalized in some type of document?
Which deliverability issue?
As far as your substantiation of what you just discussed.
As part of our analysis, I think we had provided a set of an overview of our analysis, and that level of detail was not included in it.
Did the company request an availability of transmission from MISO?
We did not seek a transmission service request for this proposal.
And why not?
Dealing with the concerns for MISO's resource adequacy rules, it was unknown as far as how a transmission service request would be worked or if it'd even be viable as part of MISO's new resource adequacy rules. And the other one is it comes at a cost. And that cost basically, as we've seen in the side-by-side, would make it almost the same, if not higher, than what our own proposal is.
When you say come at a cost, could you just please explain that further?
If you end up taking the cost for the Illinois proposal as it's bid, you're really looking at a capacity resource and an energy resource, you know, that are located three states away. And so if you end up having to look at what are the true costs, basically to be able to use that resource, or if there is any additional means, mechanisms, tools, if it's like a transmission service request, or in the case, as we talked about, how it could be used to offset a resource on our system, as far as for the WAPA IS transmission cost, there's additional cost adders that an off-system resource could incur. And so basically, as you take those pieces into account, as we looked at in the side-by-side, either the cost delta between any benefit that it provides in cost or savings basically is mitigated or is almost eliminated completely because of the cost to utilize an off-system resource.
Thank you. In your same, so it'd be MDE 107 of your direct, could you please proceed to page 6?
Yes.
And lines 19 and 20. You refer to a 155 megawatt CT and a 345 megawatt combined cycle unit. Are these planned or existing units? Resources.
If I remember correctly, the 155 megawatt resource was constructed, and the combined cycle project was an addition to the 155 megawatt resource.
Okay. And where are these two projects located?
I believe they're in Minnesota or Wisconsin.
Did you do any studies concerning, did you have any deliverability issues concerning these two projects?
We had looked at these projects. We didn't do the deliverability studies. Certainly there would be additional costs. When we ended up including them in our modeling as they were bid, because they were closer resources to our system. They're similar to capacity that we've purchased from NSP in recent years and also from WE Energies. From a locational side off our system, kind of looked at that as saying, what's the typical market price that we're looking at for capacity in outlying years? When we went through and put these in our models, they weren't selected as resources, so we didn't have to go in and look to add a transmission service request. They were already more expensive.
If you could please proceed to page 8 of your direct. And then beginning on line 19, proceeding to then page 9, 1 and 2, if you could just review that.
Yes, I've reviewed that.
What was the basis for the expected capacity factor of 10 to 20%?
The Aegeus modeling itself will actually dispatch the units on an economic basis. And so the Aegeus in year 2015 had selected an 88-megawatt resource and two 43-megawatt resources. And so in looking at the amount of energy that was looking to be forecasted to be dispatched from those particular three resources, basically, and we're only looking to construct one resource, which was the 88-megawatt, there was that amount of need that was going to be supplied from that aggregate of resources. So the potential exists that an 88-megawatt resource, an 88-megawatt resource based upon the Aegeus modeling in 2015 could supply anywhere between 10 and 20 if it would pick up the additional generation on those two 43-megawatt resources.
Perhaps you mentioned this, but does Aegeus have as one of its outputs the expected capacity factor of the unit selected?
Could you repeat that question,
certainly,
please?
Does Aegeus have as one of its outputs the expected capacity factor of the unit selected?
Yes, it does.
In the Aegeus runs that selected the 88-megawatt peaker, do you recall what the capacity factor was for that unit?
I'd have to go look. I would think it was in that 10%, but I'd have to go look.
Would it refresh your memory, but the Aegeus factors from 2015 to 2030, would that average about 4.4%? For the 88-megawatt CT?
I'm not sure. Can you repeat that?
Certainly. Isn't it true that the Aegeus capacity factor for the 88-megawatt CT from 2015 to 2030 averaged about 4.4%?
I'm not familiar with doing that analysis, so I'm not sure. I'd have to go look.
Do you know what's the heat rate for the 88-megawatt CT?
I could look it up. I think it's around 10,800.
Okay. And you remember what the heat rate was for the Tilden project? Tilden proposal, excuse me?
I think it's slightly over 10,000.
Okay. How about 8,900? Does that sound about correct?
I'd have to look. I thought it was a different value.
Okay. The Illinois CT, does that have a lower variable O&M cost than the proposed 88-megawatt peaker?
As modeled, it did. In looking at their variable O&Ms, it seems low based upon the type of balance of plant facilities that it has.
So I guess our question is, with a lower heat rate and a lower variable O&M cost for the Tilden project, wouldn't the Tilden project have a lower dispatch price than the 88-megawatt peaker?
It potentially could. It depends how it's bid into the market and where the market point is located.
So it potentially could be dispatched ahead of the MDU or the 88-megawatt peaker, is that correct?
Are we talking geographically? Is it located in Illinois as it's compared to North Dakota?
I guess please explain.
Well, if it's located three states away, the likelihood that the two of them are going to compete against each other to dispatch next, I think is very small, just because of their geographic areas. And it'll dispatch in Illinois because of what's occurring in Illinois, not because of what's occurring in North Dakota.
It would be a cheaper unit. It has a better heat rate.
From a market standpoint, yes.
So I guess our question is, wouldn't the Tilden project serve as a better hedge against higher market prices than the 88-megawatt peaker?
I would say I would not say that's correct. The hedge, if you want to hedge against market prices, you really need to have a resource that's located closer to your load, because that's ultimately what you will pay or your customers will pay. A resource that's located three states away will basically dispatch to serve the needs and what the prices are in that area. So if you end up in a situation where we have a peak day, it's hot, it's cold, and there's some large transmission outage occurs, or large generation outage that occurs here, basically we could see congestion that would basically limit the ability from power from other parts of MISO to serve our customers, of which case we end up seeing locally that prices go high, at least in this local area. And if it's an outage or a problem that could extend for a long period of time, we could basically incur paying somebody else's energy costs for a higher price unit than if we had it connected in our own system to hedge that energy supply.
Thank you. If you could proceed to your rebuttal testimony, and that it would be MDU 111 and page 8 of your rebuttal.
I'm there.
Thank you. Towards the beginning there, I believe it's line 3 in particular, you discuss the equivalent forced outage rate of 22.31% for the 43 megawatt CTs. Is that correct?
Correct.
Did you assume that EFOR value for all the 43 megawatt CTs selected by AGEUS?
We did.
Does AGEUS allow for this EFOR value to be changed from year to year?
We haven't used that tool. In reading Mr. Hahn's direct testimony, he alluded to that possibility, but it isn't something that we've pursued ourselves or have used.
So it has, AGEUS has the capacity to do it. It's just not something you've ever done before.
It may. We haven't explored that, so I don't know.
Can you just broaden that? Why is that something you haven't explored before?
I guess we haven't had a situation where we've needed to use that or try to find some way to take that, you know, changing capacity effects into account. We typically have modeled that basically the amount of capacity that a resource provides is either based upon what it historically has, or in the case of a new resource, basically it ends up remaining constant.
Now, isn't it true that in the first year of operation, MISO requires capacity resources to use a class average EFOR, but after that an individual unit's actual EFOR is used? Is that correct?
That is correct.
Do you believe that a new CT will have an EFOR that is too high or that is this high for its entire life, i.e. 22.31?
I think it's probably unlikely.
I guess just to reiterate, I'd like to next for you to refer to Exhibit DJN-3, which is part of MDU 111.
Yes.
Now, you've added annual costs for WAPA transmission to the cost of the Illinois CT. Is that correct?
Correct.
What we would like, and I guess this is kind of a compound question, I'd like to, again, for you to provide in detail what these costs are, when and why they'd be incurred, tariff and related documents of establishment, and the current rates and the basis for them.
Sure.
If you could so do so, please.
Sure, I can do that. Yep. This, the lines that we're talking about for the WAPA IS transmission, this is an offset to cost. That information is not. There's other information on this page that are, but that particular one is not. As we look at this, the WAPA IS, as we've talked about, this deals with the expiration of our transmission service agreement with WAPA on December of 2015. At that time, and we've actually have entered into network transmission service for WAPA already. As I said, we've entered into that for places where we have loads that are above the levels that are part of our existing transmission service agreement. And what WAPA has taken from a standpoint of how you calculate these loads, and these are calculations we currently look at, particularly out on the western part of our system where we don't have a connection back to MISO, we're disconnected, and we also have large amounts of growth. We basically take our system, we put it into load pockets that it has, and we disconnect all the WAPA facilities from us. And then we take a look and see, based upon company transmission and generation we have, how much of that load can we serve from what's left. And then in doing that, what we also do is take and in a contingency basis, look on an N-1 and say in a contingency, because we're really relying on WAPA to satisfy our N-1 contingencies, we also do an N-1 and basically see what's left. So there's a system intact amount of service we can provide and also an N-1 contingency. And that N-1 contingency, this is all a part of how we settle with MISO today in their current tariff as far as how we take additional service for those loads, and what it ends up paying is basically their network transmission service rate. And so the equivalent of that, if you ask WAPA what their equivalent network transmission service rate is, it calculates out to about what their firm point-to-point is. And that number today is $2.95 a kilowatt month.
Thank you. In your rebuttal testimony on page 12, you refer to some WAPA transmission costs, I believe, in relation to wind. Now, what you've just previously discussed concerning the Tilton project, are we talking about the same WAPA transmission costs, or if they're different, if you could please explain?
They're different.
Please elaborate.
Sure, because what we're currently talking about are these costs that we've added into the Illinois proposal are for network service for us to serve our load. And so if we talk about how we serve our load, if we don't have enough transmission and generation, we basically have to take service from Western to basically be able to serve our load. Okay. When we look at this project down at Hettinger, this wind project, we're looking more at delivery of energy. And what happens is if we go down to Hettinger and we look at the 230 system that's down there, we have 50 megawatts of rights that we have on that transmission system. There are some upgrades that are occurring. That number is expected to go to 75 megawatts of rights that we'll have on that system. But from an energy standpoint, what happens is the energies want to flow to the south. If you look at the path that comes out of Hettinger, and ultimately one of the network upgrades that was required was a phase-shifting transformer to keep those flows off the IS. If you can't do something to keep those flows off the IS from an energy standpoint, depending who the off-taker is, just to get that energy to serve your customers, whether it's ours or somebody else, is a charge that somebody potentially could have to incur from WAPA.
Thank you. Earlier, we were talking about WAPA transmission costs related to the Tilton purchase. Are these costs applicable solely to the Tilton purchase, or why, or why not?
They would be applicable to any off-system resource. And so depending where we would add new resources or new transmission facilities on our system, we could basically show we have additional deliverability capability or resources that could serve our load.
If you could please reiterate, what is MDU's existing transmission agreement with WAPA?
We have a transmission sharing agreement is what it currently is. And that agreement expires in December of 2015. It has in it historical load points for both MDU and also WAPA's customers that it serves as a part of that agreement. So you go back, and I think the last time the exhibits were updated, I think is like, it was in the late 80s, early 90s. And in that, we take a look and say that was the amount of load that each party said that they had at that time. Those exhibits haven't been updated since then. So what WAPA has done is they said, your load has grown and you're above those historic levels. And because we're above those in certain places, they said you have to take network transmission service.
When was this agreement first signed between MDU and WAPA?
I think it's been signed and extended a few times. I think the particular date on this one goes back, I think, to 88 or 83 or 88. But there would have been one that would have preceded it.
Now, you mentioned that your WAPA transmission agreement between MDU and WAPA expires. Is there any potentiality that it could be renewed?
No, we've tried that. It's one of those, it does not have any extension rights that are part of that. And so there's no evergreen clauses, there's no renewal terms that are part of that. It's a hard set to expire. And it's one of those agreements, at least looking with FERC, of saying, you know, it doesn't, from the standpoint of open access, it's a different rate. So the places that agreement will expire and will basically be taking replacement service, if there is reciprocal, from each other's tariff.
Just so I understand correctly, so the fact that it can't be renewed, is that because WAPA doesn't choose to renew it, or if you could please explain?
Two parts. WAPA, when we've entertained them, if there would be any way to do it, they have said they're not willing to, and the other one is looking at FERC and with open access treatment of tariffs, I think we believe that it's not capable of being basically renewed is what it would be, because there's no extension terms in it.
If If it had been renewed, though, would that have eliminated the WAPA transmission costs related to the Tilden project, Tilden proposal?
You still have, ultimately, in the future, have to go off and look at what your position is for transmission resources and also generating resources in the future. One of the places that we get with Heskett Station, you know, we've not talked about retiring a unit there, but ultimately, if we end up having a unit retirement that occurs at Heskett Station or anywhere on our system, that's actually less resources that we have that can serve our load in the future. So what this does is it allows us to offset costs today, plus it offsets additional, you know, the potential for other unit retirements in the future.
Thank you. If you could please now, one moment. Will WAPA pay MDU for sharing MDU's transmission facilities, or is this a one-way? Just one moment, please. Okay, excuse me, I'll reiterate. Will WAPA pay MDU for sharing MDU's transmission facilities, or is this a one-way street whereby MDU will pay and WAPA will not?
There's two pieces that work in this. One is the WAPA transmission service agreement, when it expires, you know, there's certain service of loads that MDU receives on the WAPA system. And the other one, there are certain loads that WAPA's, some of their REC members receive. One of the other agreements that works in conjunction with this is actually the Basin Common Use Agreement. And so under that Common Use Agreement, there is another transmission sharing agreement that Montana, Dakota has where the co-ops have made investments on our transmission system in various places. That also allows the co-ops to basically, or Basin to basically wheel power across our system. And so when we've looked at, is this a reciprocal thing where we're basically going to pay the same dollars back to each other just under a different tariff? The answer is no, because we'll take a lot more service than they will. And the other one is Basin's members largely will be able to use the terms under the Common Use Agreement to basically continue to wield that power.
Is that entirely the logic behind, I guess, your answering this question? Is there something else as well? Is there any other logic that you're aware of?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
Is this the entire story? I mean, is there something out there also that's part of this analysis?
No, we have two transmission service, basically two transmission agreements that we have with WAPA and Basin. One is there's an agreement we've talked about that's this transmission service agreement that expires in 2015. The other one is the common use agreement. They both basically provide, as far as it goes with the co-op loads, the REC loads, which is what we're talking about. Is there a reciprocal revenue that we'll receive when the WAPA IS transmission agreement expires that we have, or the WAPA tariff agreement, that basically the two of them work in conjunction today, and they largely will be left with just the common use agreement. Once we get to 2016, it'll be the only one left. And that does provide abilities because of investments that Basin and its members have made on our system that they can basically wheel power in certain places across our system.
Thank you.
And that one does not have an expiration date to it, so it continues to evergreen.
Before in your slide, you discussed that with the current federal budget constraints, it seems likely that the production tax credit, if it is extended, will be at a reduced funding level. What's the basis for your statement?
That's just my opinion.
Could then please proceed to page 17 of your rebuttal testimony. Once you get there, lines 14 through 16, if you could please review that.
I've read it.
You state that no adjustments were made in the AGEUS modeling assumptions for the Tilton proposal related to the deliverability issues that the company had with this resource. Why didn't the company include such adjustments?
I think at the time of the modeling that was done, the largest unknown dealt with MISO's capacity construct. And so from the standpoint of having a resource that far off our system, there really is no way to quantify if and how a resource that's located that far away could be used on our system. You know, in hindsight, looking at how an adjustment could be made, and that would be as if you wanted this proposal to have been considered a grandmothered agreement, we would have had to add in the cost for a transmission service request from Illinois back to MDU, which could have been added into the modeling that, as we did in the site. It could have been added back into the modeling for an additional cost that we could have done post the analysis.
Thank you. If you could please now proceed to page 23 of your rebuttal testimony. And once you get there, if you could review lines 1 through 9.
I've reviewed it.
Thank you. Now, you state that, I guess I'm quoting, changes in MISO membership, whether that is MDU or others, could impact the ability to utilize capacity from Illinois. For example, MDU's only connection to MISO is contingent upon OTP's continuation as a MISO member. If either MDU or Otter Tail were to withdraw from MISO, MDU would be required to secure a transmission service request, if available and if economic, to show a deliverability of the capacity resource from Illinois to North Dakota to utilize capacity from an Illinois resource. So I guess my first question is, does MDU have any plans to exit MISO?
At this time, we do not.
And what is MDU's knowledge of OTP's plans to remain in or withdraw from MISO?
I would say that would be Otter Tail's plans, but that they have over potential issues provided letters to MISO at least the last few years addressing a potential for withdrawals if certain things would occur or if there were certain changes.
So I guess it's fair to say it's somewhat speculation as to whether or not OTP is going to withdraw from MISO. Is that correct?
Correct.
Under that contingency, if OTP were to withdraw, would that require FERC approval?
For Otter Tail to withdraw from MISO?
From MISO, correct.
Yes, it would.
And also probably the public service, North Dakota Public Service Commission, the local regulators as well. Would that be correct?
Possible. I'm not sure as far as what all the procedures would have to take place.
Historically, and I believe you alluded to this before, are you familiar with other withdrawals from RTOs?
Not neighboring utilities, but from others within the MISO footprint.
I guess from what you remember, could you provide some examples?
The most recent one that's occurred is with First Energy.
Okay. If you could please elaborate, I guess, what you remember about that situation.
That First Energy elected to withdraw from MISO and adjoin a neighboring RTO being PJM.
Under that scenario, how did FERC respond? What did they do under that scenario? How did they deal with the adverse effects of the withdrawal, more specifically?
The part that I'm familiar with dealt with their cost obligations. And so monitoring pieces from a transmission owner's perspective, there are certain cost allocation expenditure treatments that they basically had to agree to continue to pay and fund for a period of time post their withdrawal. That's the part I'm familiar with.
Thank you. If you could, on the same page, on lines 10 through 11, if you could review that.
I reviewed it.
Thank you. Now, just reiterating, just a year ago, any network resource in MISO was fully deliverable across the footprint for capacity obligation purposes. Isn't it true that under MISO's proposed locational capacity market, purchases that were executed prior to a certain date would continue to be counted towards meeting a capacity obligation?
Only if they have a transmission service request, is my understanding.
And there must, there's a threshold date involved as well, correct?
July 15, 2011.
Thank you. That's my next question. I guess in hindsight, it had MDU sign the agreement to purchase the Tilton Power in 2010. When it was offered, wouldn't MDU be able to count that capacity towards its obligation?
Can you repeat the question again, please?
Certainly. In hindsight, if you would have signed the Tilton proposal on that date, wouldn't you have been able to avoid, or wouldn't you have been able then to be able to count the capacity towards your obligation, notwithstanding this new proposed scheme by MISO?
No. My understanding is that if we would have signed that prior to July 15, 2011, we also would have had to have a corresponding transmission service agreement. So we would have had to have done that study to see if it was available, and plus we would have had to incur those additional costs.
All right. I'm gonna ask you to go to your other testimony, your direct testimony, which again is
107.
Thank you. 107, page 9 of 107. Once you get there, I'd like you to review lines 13 through 22, please.
I've reviewed it.
Thank you. My question is, since we're in a situation of excess capacity, shouldn't we be taking advantage of MISO capacity purchases rather than building plant? And please explain.
We actually have taken advantage of some of that already, because as we've looked at securing some of our short-term requirements, we actually have made purchases in the current voluntary capacity auction. You know, the issue with longer-term auctions is the amount of time if pricing would go to Cone and you would have a shortage. You know, the question is, how quickly can you react to that? That if it goes deficit and you haven't made plans, or depending how long you depend upon that, you really become at the mercy of what that market price is. And as we've looked at the potential for the EPA pending rules, and as far as potential for impacts and where those capacity margins go, we can end up seeing how quickly they could be depleted.
But that, what you just said, that could be reconciled somewhat by the fact that the PPA proposal was for 20 years. You could correspondingly go back to Tilton and say we would have wanted something shorter to be able to hedge against the concerns you just testified to. Isn't that correct?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that again, please?
Certainly. What you had indicated as far as taking advantage of a high capacity, or the type of situation where we have more capacity than typical. You had discussed about you discussed about Cone and the situation of the variability as time goes on. It's my understanding, at least from our from previous testimony, in that with this PPA being 20 years, it doesn't allow you to react accordingly. However, if this Tilton PPA, if you were to have asked for it to be shortened from 20 to some other period of time, 3, 5, or something like that, wouldn't that somewhat hedge against the concerns you just testified to?
It ends up hedging until the time that shorter term then expires. And then as far as at that point, you're once again subjected to what that current market price is, where if there's a high amount of demand, it usually means the supply costs are more expensive.
Are you familiar with the cost per kilowatt month in the first year of the 88 megawatt peaker?
I am not.
Just one moment, Your Honor. It's my understanding, however, that you could probably calculate it pretty quick, but you'd have to use probably some trade secret material to do so. Isn't that correct, to answer my question?
I don't think it'd be trade secret. I think it would be public.
Okay. And that's great that it's public, but that's something you could calculate right
now. Yeah, we would just take the revenue requirement and what fixed costs and divide that by the capacity times 12.
Okay. Do you have that value, or is this going to take a lengthy period of time, or?
It would take me a few minutes to end up finding the appropriate number. And then I would end up needing a calculator. It is not in one of the exhibits that I have in front of me, so I'd have to go get an additional document.
Mr. Grumman, I don't want to interrupt your train of thought, so hang on to it. It's sufficiently close to the noon hour that I would entertain willingly a request to recess for lunch.
I think that's a very good idea to make such a request, Your Honor.
Accordingly, we will be in recess until 1 o'clock.